It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered my home.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and threaten me.
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
And maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 828 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, October 1st, 2023. I am the Solo Monster. It is Wrestle Dreams Sunday, big AEW pay-per-view coming up tonight. The start of a new era. That's the tagline. That's what the announcers were pushing on Collision last night, and Tony Khan's been saying it all week. Something big is going down tonight. Could be any number of things. We're going to talk about what those could be, because I'm going to run down the entire Wrestle Dream card, give my thoughts and predictions. We're going to talk about the possibility of a big free agent signing for Tony Khan as well. And unfortunate news when it comes to the state of Adam Cole. So there's a lot of AEW stuff to get into. Last night, NXT had a big event out in California called No Mercy, which is an event that many of you have seen before. Usually it's under the WWE banner. This was the first one under the NXT banner. And it will go down as one of the better shows you'll see all year because of the 2 main event matches on last night's show, where they knocked it out of the park. So we're going to talk about No Mercy. We're going to get to your questions. We're going to talk about Jade. Let's just dive into it here. I want to say thank you to all of our PayPal producers for this week. You guys are awesome. You can always make a donation on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link at the very top of the link tree. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, always showing up and showing out. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Big B, Brian Pissera, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Daredevil, Doug Lippert, Fast Blast Tim Banks, Killshot Keith Hart, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, Sweet Sapphire Sarah Kittleson dropping some early birthday love on me, and Sarah, I am feeling much better, so thank you for the kind words. I appreciate that. Chris from Bethlehem turned 38 on Friday, and he was hoping for a Vince McMahon birthday shout-out. I don't know. I mean, he's kind of busy right now. Yeah, he's counting his big fat stack of money over there in the corner, but he does, happy birthday, Chris. Happy birthday, Grant. That's literally the Vince McMahon impression these days. If it sounds awful, it's because he sounds awful. When I hear him speak, that's what it sounds like to me. He sounds like a rotting corpse. Happy birthday from WWE. Anyway, Chris, have a great birthday. The fighting artist, AJ Lupo, would like to give a special shout out to his wrestling buddies and good friends as they are working on their journey to become pro wrestlers themselves. So the man on the front line, Johnny, Tide Rider, JC Rivers, the student of the game, Isaac Wayne, top of the class, Kai Reynolds, and Anomaly L.I. J-Maz. And he says, see you soon at HOG. I will see you there. We got Minoru Suzuki coming in. We got Mike Santana wrestling Rocky Romero. All coming up on Friday the 13th. It's going to be a good one. AEW was silent on the status of Adam Cole heading into Dynamite this week, which was concerning. This was after he came out at the end of the MJF Samoa Joe match at Arthur Ashe 2 weeks ago. He jumped off the elevated ramp to the ring. He immediately started limping, but he was doing his best to no-sell it. He went to the hospital that night. He was seen leaving on crutches, which did not sound very promising. On Wednesday, we got the bad news, and it was a worst-case scenario for AEW that Adam Cole did, in fact, break his ankle. But not only did he break his ankle, he broke it in 3 places, and he tore ligaments in the ankle as well, and he will need surgery to repair all of the damage. Remember this, the next time you're watching an AEW show, like tonight, and you see someone taking a pile driver on the apron, or doing a 630 through a table on the floor, that just by jumping down from the ramp Adam Cole broke his ankle in three places. You can't predict these things. That's why they call them freak accidents. But it's a huge blow because Cole and MJF are the top act in the company. And they have had a long-term story playing out since June. And now it throws a monkey wrench into whatever plans they had. A lot of people immediately scream work because they've been conditioned to think that everything in wrestling is a work. And it is always possible that they are exaggerating the severity of the injury and that maybe he'll be back a lot sooner, although they don't even have a timetable for his return. There are a lot of people who think, you know, John Cena's torn pec wasn't as bad as they made it out to be, and that's why he was able to come back so quickly in the Royal Rumble in 2008. It's not his mutant healing powers. They just made it out to be worse than it was, so it would make him look better coming back so soon. And look, it's possible. I mean, look, anything is possible. What I can tell you, though, is that Adam Cole is very much hurt, and hurt badly, and he's going to miss a lot of time, at least in the ring. You know, Britt Baker posted photos of his ankle on social media. She posted an x-ray. It looked gnarly. Fightful says that she is expected to miss a few weeks of TV time to take care of him, drive him around, because he obviously can't drive himself. On Dynamite, he was ready to relinquish the Ring of Honor tag team titles. He had his leg in a big cast. He was sitting in a chair in the ring. MJF stopped him and said he would defend the tag team titles all by himself. And Cole's title would be waiting for him when he came back. And he said he would defend the titles tonight at WrestleDream all by himself against the Righteous. And that's when Switchblade Jay White came out. We got a great back and forth war of words between the two to tease a future championship match. I hope at Full Gear and not their Title Tuesday show in 10 days, because that would be way too soon to do it. They're taping Dynamite and Rampage together on a Tuesday because of the MLB playoffs. I think it's a great pivot, if that's what it is, to go to MJF and Jay White. That's a match that I would love to see. They had a cliffhanger ending at the end of Dynamite where a group of guys all in black were beating up Jay White in the back. And one of the men, who never got physical, he never joined in on the attack, but he was standing there watching and he was wearing MJF's devil mask. And he turned to look into the camera. Now, all you have to do is look at the guy to know that it wasn't MJF under the mask. And it wasn't Adam Cole either. Although, depending on how long the story drags on for, who's to say it can't be Adam Cole next year when he's ready to come back? It doesn't even really matter who was under the mask on Wednesday. It could have been anybody. You know, you have people trying to figure out whose shoulders are those. Oh, I know those shoulders anywhere. Funniest shit I've seen in a long time. It could have been the fucking ice cream man from the concession stands on the third level under the mask. Doesn't matter. Once we get the actual reveal, it'll be somebody else. But it was not MJF. I don't know who it's going to be. I'm intrigued by the whole thing. I think it's smart for them to do a cliffhanger ending. I hope it's one of these things where they've given this some thought and it's not like, well, we got to come up with something to hook people in and we'll just sort of book it on the fly. You know, we'll figure it out as we go. I'm not even sure WWE knew who ran down Stone Cold when they did that angle back in 99, but, you know, they had almost a year to figure it out. And even then it was underwhelming. So they'll get that whole thing figured out, even if they don't already, you know who it's going to be. Tony Khan is trying to take a negative and turn it into a positive. They can do the next Cole-MJF match next year. MJF will still be there. I don't know if he'll still be the champion by then, but he'll still be there. He is not leaving. He's not going to WWE. He's probably already re-signed months ago. If not, then he will soon. He is not going to WWE. They're going to play up the bidding war of 2024, but he is not going anywhere. So they can revisit it when Cole is healthy again. I mean, MJF, he's the face of that place. And he's still so young, he could sign with AEW for another 3, 4, 5 years if he wants to, and still be young enough to be a big star in WWE the next time his contract comes up if he wants. Now, tonight is WrestleDream. In Seattle, at the Climate Pledge Arena, the last time they were there was for the first Dynamite of 2023. They did over 9,100 fans in the building that night for this pay-per-view, with a pretty stacked lineup, they still have not crossed 6,000 fans. They have the building set up for about 7,500. This is a pay-per-view with Bryan Danielson, Swerve Strickland, Darby Allin, all in feature matches on the show, all local guys. There's no reason an episode of Dynamite should be outselling this show. So we'll see what kind of walk-up they do. And it is a big show. You know, Tony Khan, he continues to push this narrative that this is going to be the start of a new era for AEW. The announcers were really pushing it again on Collision last night. I think it could be the announcement of a Max deal and monthly pay-per-views, because that would certainly mark the beginning of a new era for this company if they went to monthly pay-per-views. If not that, I don't know what it could be in reference to. But I am excited for the show tonight. We've got four matches announced for the 0 Hour pre-show. Local boy Nick Wayne takes on Luchasaurus. Seattle or not, Nick Wayne should not be beating Luchasaurus. This should be a win for the Dinosaur. The Acclaimed and Billy Gunn defend their AEW Trios titles against the Mighty Don't Kneel from New Japan Pro Wrestling. Zack Sabre Jr. is part of the group. He's on the main card. But here it's Shane Haste, Mikey Nichols, and Bad Dude Tito. My magic 8-ball tells me Bad Dude Tito is not walking out as 1/3 of the AEW Trios champions. And they added two more matches on Collision last night. A 4-on-4 mixed tag team match. On one side, Shane Taylor, Lee Moriarty, Mercedes Martinez, and Diamante. On the other side, Satoshi Kojima, Keith Lee, Athena, and Billy Starks. So I'm going with Kojima, Lee, Athena, and Starks. And Claudio Castagnoli goes 1-on-1. He laid down the challenge. He's going 1-on-1 with Josh Barnett, one of Antonio Inoki's proteges, one of his prized pupils, making his AEW debut. So it makes sense for an Inoki tribute show to have Josh Barnett on there in some way. And he's yet another Seattle boy. You know, they're throwing this one on the pre-show for free. This could be on the main card, but they're putting this on the pre-show, so that has my attention. I think Claudio takes it. One big name missing from the show altogether is Jon Moxley, who lost his international title to Rey Fénix at Grand Slam. He got concussed. He called an audible during the match for Fénix to beat him for the belt. It messed up plans that Tony Khan had for someone outside of AEW to come in to challenge Moxley for the championship on this show. Now, I'm thinking it was probably going to be Barnett. Barnett has a victory over Moxley 2 years ago on one of the Bloodsport shows that Barnett runs. Bodyslam.net had a report this week, though, that it was supposed to be Filthy Tom Lawler. The same Tom Lawler who was supposed to make his AEW debut at Forbidden Door this year against Adam Cole before Cole got pulled at the last minute with an undisclosed illness. So he ended up wrestling Serpentico in a dark match instead. That's quite the come down. If that's true, I mean, how snake bit is that guy? You know, I said on the stream Wednesday I thought it might have been Sami Callihan, because I know he and Moxley are pretty tight. Moxley has worked for Callahan's promotion, his Wrestling Revolver promotion before. And Callahan revealed this past week that his contract with Impact Wrestling was expiring. And he was entering free agency as of yesterday, September 30th. So the timing would have lined up perfectly for him to debut here one day after he becomes a free agent. Now, there are still said to be people with Moxley leading the pack who are pushing very hard for Tony Khan to sign Callahan. So this could still be a landing spot for him, because as of this morning, he is officially a free agent. So we'll see where he ends up. On the main card, we've got MJF defending the Ring of Honor tag team titles all by himself in a handicap match against The Righteous, Vincent and Dutch. No Adam Cole. I am not convinced that MJF is going to go it alone. I could see Roderick Strong volunteering to be his partner. I thought they were going to set this up, honestly, on Wednesday, especially when Roddy came out with the whole idea being that, okay, well, if Adam can't go, then I'll be happy to take his place. Or maybe Cole would ask MJF, would you do me a solid and let Roddy take my place, and then reluctantly MJF agrees. So they didn't do that, but I still think there's a good chance Roddy ends up volunteering to be his partner at the last minute, and MJF indulges him because, again, he's Adam's boy. And they win, and Roddy takes Cole's place as one half of the tag team champions until the Kingdom eventually get their title shot. And when they do, Roddy basically throws the match and helps the Kingdom win the ROH tag team titles. With or without a tag team partner, MJF retains tonight. But he's going to need a partner at some point. He can't go months, you know, beating teams 2-on-1. I don't care if he is the AEW World Champion. You'll destroy the whole fucking division if you keep doing that. So you either get the belts off of him, or he's got to find a new tag team partner. Now, MJF does not need to be one half of the Ring of Honor Tag Team Champions. He did not need to be one half of the Ring of Honor Tag Team Champions when they won the belts. It was all part of the story. If they want to keep the story going, then he'll retain the titles. If not, then let him drop the belt and get them the fuck away from him. But I don't think they're ready to get the belts off of him just yet. So, if that's the case and he's going to need a tag team partner, Roddy is the one who would make the most sense. Now, there is another idea. And I was already thinking about this before I got this email from Armando, but I want to give Armando a shout out. He sent me this email yesterday, but on Friday night, Wardlow, remember him? Yes, Wardlow, he's still around. He posted a tweet. Actually, he was replying to someone telling him that they missed him. And Wardlow said, "I miss me too." It's really sad what happened to this guy and how much his stock has fallen. But I saw that tweet going around and it got me thinking about old Wardlow. Maybe there's a silver lining in this Adam Cole injury for him. Now, Armando said he thinks that someone should be MJF's partner. That man should be Wardlow. And in his scenario, MJF accepts, and when it looks like the hot tag is coming, Wardlow punches him and he costs MJF the match. And then he beats MJF down after, and Wardlow is back all of a sudden with some momentum. Plus, you can have the two feud again, and this time the roles would be reversed. Right, Wardlow would be the heel, MJF would be the babyface. Where that falls apart for me, with Wardlow just randomly offering to be his partner, yeah, just because of the way things were left between them, why would he want to help MJF? And why would MJF trust him enough to say yes and accept? All it does is make MJF look like an idiot when Wardlow turns on him. And you shouldn't want your world champion to look like a fool. But them becoming partners and doing the betrayal later on, that's not a bad idea. You just can't rush it like that. But I do think there's a way to do it. You just have to tell that story. Why would Wardlow want to be with him? Why would he want Wardlow's help? If you can explain that, and you could come up with a way to explain it. All it takes is one promo in the middle of the ring on Dynamite. But just take your time with it. You don't rush into it like that. But the other problem with doing it that way that he described is that they've already set up Jay White as MJF's next opponent. But reuniting him and Wardlow for a little while before Wardlow turns on him and then Wardlow wants his shot at the AEW World title, that's a story that I can get behind. Because the last time they fought, Wardlow powerbombed this fucker 10 times and he pinned him. Now MJF is the world champion. Wardlow should want a shot at the title. He should have wanted it right after MJF won it a year ago. But better late than never. There is a way for them to work Wardlow into this now that Adam Cole is going to be down for a while. But just don't rush right through it. Don't rush into it. Take your time with it. But he's got Switchblade first. Ricky Starks goes one-on-one with Wheeler Yuta. This is a match that was made after a backstage confrontation the two had following Ricky's Texas Death Match with Bryan Danielson on Collision last week. Ricky has taken some losses recently. CM Punk, Bryan Danielson. He's due for a big win. Actually, I wouldn't call a win over Wheeler Yuta a big win, but it is a win that he should absolutely get, and I think he will get. Chris Statlander defends the TBS championship against Julia Hart. Julia Hart is on a 27 or 28, I think it might be 28 match win streak now after last night. Her last loss was back in April of last year. And that loss came at the hands of Chris Statlander. Now, I would not take the title off of Statlander here, and not for Julia Hart, although I wouldn't hate it if they wanted to do something with Julia, but I don't think that this is the right person or the right time for it. Statlander should retain. But I will say about Julia Hart, I've been liking her work of late. In the ring, she's definitely gotten better. Her character stuff, her entrance, her music, some of these vignettes they've done with her, all quality stuff. She's still very young. She's not even 21 years old yet. Not for another month. But you could already see the progression that she has made. So she's on the right track. But putting the title on her right now would not be the move to make. We have the Young Bucks, the Guns, the Lucha Bros, and Orange Cassidy and Hook in a four-way match. This is for a future AEW World Tag Team title match. Could be at any time. They didn't specify when. It's not necessarily at Full Gear next month. Probably on television. They do have Title Tuesday coming up on October 10th. That would be a sensible place to expect it. The oddball pairing here, and the one team that we have not seen FTR work with, is Orange Cassidy and Hook. And for that reason, I think they get the win here. Don't let Orange Cassidy's win in the four-way on Wednesday over Matt Jackson, Penta, and Austin Gunn fool you. He can win again here, and I think he will. He needs something to do after losing the international title, and his stock is still pretty high in this company. Hook has lost, what, one match in his career? So we just saw FTR against the Bucks. The Bucks just won the Ring of Honor six-man titles. So I don't see the need for them to win here. I'm picking Orange Cassidy and Hook. Who would I like to see win? I've been liking what the Guns have been doing as part of Bullet Club Gold. I wouldn't mind seeing them pick up the win. But I think Cassidy and Hook are probably going to take it. Eddie Kingston, the brand new Ring of Honor World Champion. The New Japan Openweight Champion, New Japan Strong Openweight Champion. He will defend both of those titles against the Ring of Honor Pure Champion, Katsuyori Shibata. His title is not on the line. Eddie's titles are on the line. Kingston, by the way, has signed a new deal with AEW that's going to keep him with the company for another 4 years. So if you're not tired of Eddie Kingston yet, you got four more years of him. Shibata, we all know Shibata's great. I mean, if you're not familiar with Shibata, we know what he can do in the ring. Eddie has had some fun matches this summer. You know, Shibata is the Ring of Honor Pure Champion. So we've seen him in some matches technically that have been great. Eddie wrestles a very different style. Eddie isn't really a technical wrestler. He's a brawler. So I don't know. Sometimes you get a clash of styles in matches like this. I'm expecting a chop fest. Hopefully no headbutts. But in the end, I think it's pretty clear Eddie Kingston is not losing the ROH world title. Just won the fucking thing. He's not losing the Ring of Honor world title here. So this will be a win for Eddie Kingston. FTR defend the AEW tag team titles against Aussie Open. 1 year ago today, they had their Royal Quest match, which a lot of people called it a five-star match. One of the best matches of the year last year. When it was over, Dax Harwood got on the mic. He called them the future of tag team wrestling. He said maybe the best tag team in the world today, Aussie Open. That's high praise. They are not the future AEW World Tag Team Champions, however. Not tonight. FTR retains in a match that could very well steal the show. I mean, there's no less than half a dozen matches on this card that could steal the show. But this is definitely at the top of the list, I would say. But there's no reason for FTR to lose the titles here. And then we have Bryan Danielson, one-on-one with Zack Sabre Jr. in what they are billing as a dream match. And for a lot of fans, it is. I mean, that word gets thrown around a lot. I can't tell you that I have a whole lot of dream matches on my personal list that are left that I would look at and go, okay, that's a dream match. I wouldn't consider this a dream match, but again, for some people it would be. For Bryan Danielson, it's a dream match. He has wanted to wrestle Zack Sabre for years, and they were supposed to wrestle at Forbidden Door last year. Bryan got hurt, though. He wasn't cleared in time. That's when Claudio debuted. He took his spot. After the main event on Collision last night, Sabre was ringside doing commentary. Danielson stared him down, so Sabre got into the ring. We had a face-off. Sabre shoved him. He slapped him. Danielson slapped him back. He went for the lapel lock, and Sabre escaped. And that's the only physical interaction we've had between these two. You know, Brian has done a lot of media this week for this show, and he has joked about not wanting to go on last on these pay-per-views, just because the competition for the best match is always so fierce on these AEW shows. You know, it's a lot of pressure. And also, these shows are so fucking long. I mean, well, I'm not even through the whole card yet. We'll talk about how many matches there are. But between all of the competition and between the fact that, you know, these shows go so late that these crowds can be exhausted by the end, unless you can really bring them back up. So I don't blame him for not wanting to go on last. I wouldn't want to go on last either on one of these shows. And it sounds like he's not going to have to worry about that because I don't think they are going on last. But there's no storyline here beyond who is the best technical wrestler in the world today. That's it. That's the story. Very similar to the build-up to his match with Okada in June. And a lot of that was due to the fact that Okada was in Japan, so he just wasn't available to be on television every week. But there was no contract signing. There was no can they coexist tag team match on TV. They relied for that match on video packages and their reputations in the business to get the match over. You didn't have to do anything. It was Okada against Danielson. That sells it all by itself to the wrestling audience. Two of the greatest of all time. Two of the best to ever do it. That was a match for the hardcore wrestling fan who knows who Okada is and they know who Bryan Danielson is. This match is exactly the same, although Sabre is not as big of a star as Okada is. The average fan doesn't know who Zack Sabre Jr. is. But this is not a match for the average fan. It may be a match that wins over some average fans if they happen to be watching the show and if they happen to really like the technical aspect of pro wrestling, and some people do. Some casual fans do like the technical matches. So maybe they'll win some fans over. But again, that's who the match is really for. Now, they're also in Seattle. So Danielson is going to be super over no matter what. And there's no reason for him to take the loss here. I mean, he beat Okada. Right? Why would he be losing to Zack Sabre Jr.? He's too valuable to AEW right now with CM Punk being gone. He just got two straight wins over Ricky Starks. The next time Danielson loses in an AEW ring, it should be to an AEW talent. You know, if he works the Tokyo Dome next year, he can lose to Okada. So Okada gets his win back in a New Japan ring. That's fine. But he should not be losing on this show. And I don't think he will. It also sounds like Danielson in the G1 next year is about as much of a dream as this match is. He did an interview this week and said, "Sometimes I have delusions of doing the G1. I think that's what they are. I think that they're delusions in the sense of, that's something I've wanted to do forever and ever and ever. I've never been able to do it. This year would be the year to do it. Except, is it? By the time the next G1 rolls around, I'll be 43, and with how many injuries? That's a big part of why I want to step away from full-time wrestling also. To do this, I love doing this, but it's not worth the expense of my health later on in life. I've already had enough injuries as it is. Right now, I feel like the injuries that I've had are manageable in the sense of long term. I'm constantly doing stuff from my neck so that my neck isn't bad when I'm 70. The concussion stuff, I do my best, but all of us were just hoping for the best. We don't know. There is no concrete science on it. I think now doing a G1 might be a little irresponsible of me in comparison to what my overall long-term goals are, which is being there for my kids and my family." As much as I'd love to see Danielson do the G1, if he's worried about getting hurt, then it's not worth it. You know, Kingston held up. Somehow, Eddie Kingston worked the G1 this year, and he managed to not get hurt. But Danielson, he wrestles a very different style than Eddie Kingston does. A lot more physical. And I don't want to see the man cripple himself. We have Hangman Adam Page, one-on-one with Swerve Strickland. They had a contract signing on Dynamite Wednesday. Hangman said that for a year and a half, he would come to work with a little black cloud over his head that he just couldn't get rid of. A little black cloud named Phil. He said whenever he would start to smile, that black cloud returned and it started to rain. He said that's over now, and he weathered the storm. And Swerve said he's going to take Paige's position from him, and oh, by the way, it rains a lot in Seattle. I thought that was a killer line. This is a win that Swerve needs. This is a win that Swerve Strickland should get. This match should be about getting Swerve to that next level. And beating a former AEW World Champion would help do that. So I think he should absolutely win this round. And they could always stretch it out to full gear. They could run it back again. Especially if they go out there tonight and have a great match, which I'm expecting they will. You know, it's not like I wouldn't love to see them go at least one more time. So this could be the first of several meetings they have. But when I look at this and I say, who benefits the most from walking out of this match with a W tonight? It's Swerve Strickland. And so I'm picking Swerve to get the win here. I am very happy to see him and Hangman have something to really sink their teeth into, especially Hangman, because it just feels to me like, yeah, they put the Ring of Honor six-man titles on him and the Bucks, but like, who cares? You know, it doesn't do anything for them. It just seems kind of pointless. Like, Tony Khan is just using them to try to bolster the Ring of Honor brand, which, again, is what makes me think there's some kind of deal in the works here, because he's really been trying to put some star power behind the Ring of Honor name in recent weeks. They got fucking MJF walking around with the Ring of Honor tag team titles. So something is definitely going on there, but it's been so long since Hangman has really had anything of substance on the show to do. So this is a match I'm looking forward to. Hopefully this can drag out a little bit longer. Now we have a trios match. We have Kenny Omega, we have Chris Jericho, and we have Kota Ibushi teaming up to take on the Don Callis family of Konosuke Takeshita, Sammy Guevara, and Will, by God, Ospreay. How can this be anything but fantastic? Just look at who's involved. Just look at the star power involved. Look at the talent involved. Callis just formed this new group, this new family. I think you get more heat on them by having them go over. So I'm predicting a win for Ospreay, Takeshita, and Guevara. Ospreay doesn't need to win the match for his team. Either Takeshita pins Ibushi or have Sammy pick up his first big win for the family and let Sammy pin Chris Jericho. That's how I would do it. I think it goes one of those two ways. You know, they went to Tokyo, they beat up Ibushi in his own dojo, and someone posted a photo online, actually video too, of the vignette. They shot this vignette on the streets of Tokyo. When, if you remember Dynamite on Wednesday, we saw Callis and Takeshita just standing there. They were in the middle, I don't know where they were. They were on the street somewhere. There were people all around them. And they just filmed this little promo about how, you know, we're in Tokyo, we're hunting for Ibushi. We're looking for Ibushi. And so anyway, these photos and a video got posted by somebody online. One of the people who happened to be walking around, I guess, was a fan. And they said, oh shit, they're filming something for AEW. So they pulled their phone out. And they exposed that the person filming the vignette with his phone was Kenny Omega. Can't make this shit up. Which means it was probably Omega who filmed Ibushi getting the shit kicked out of him at the dojo later. Say it ain't so. Baron Corbin will not be happy about this. We'll see how many of you get that reference. And as far as Ibushi is concerned, now you guys have heard me saying that. How many times have I said this over the last few months? I've said, I guarantee you, the reason that, you know, Ibushi, we see him out there the way that he is, and he's been hidden away, no singles matches or anything, this guy is hurt. This guy is not 100%. Well, Kota Ibushi gave an interview to Sports Illustrated, and guess what he told Sports Illustrated? He's not fully recovered, and he's dealing with more injuries. He said, I cannot say that I am completely better. Newer injuries have proven difficult. However, my fighting style will never be limited. I will continue to find a way to fight. So there it is. Kota Ibushi is wrestling hurt. And so for all the people saying, well, why does he look different? He looks a little softer in the upper body than he used to be and all that. Well, he is older. But I'm telling you, this guy cannot train upper body the way that he used to. So that is the update from Kota Ibushi, but there it is. I mean, I've been saying it now for months, and to hear him say it, it sucks that he's still hurt. He mentions newer injuries, but, you know, it's pretty apparent when you watch him out there. This is a different person. This is not the same Kota Ibushi from 2 years ago in New Japan when he hurt his shoulder in the finals of the G1 against Okada. It's like two different people. I hope that one day he can get back to that where he's 100% or as close to 100% as he can be, and he can train like he used to and be the old Kota Ibushi. But this guy is clearly hurting. You could just see it when he's out there. Full Gear, I'm guessing, I'm looking ahead now to Full Gear. Full Gear is probably the Omega Takeshita rematch and the Jericho Sammy rematch. So that's why I say you have either Takeshita, you know, put the final nail in the coffin for Ibushi here, right? His best friend, Kenny Omega's best friend, put more heat on that feud before the eventual rematch. Or you give the win to Sammy. Because when I look at this and I say, who could benefit the most? Just like the Hangman Swerve match, who benefits the most by going over here? It's Sammy Guevara. He just joined the Don Callis family. Jericho already beat him on television, right, a Grand Slam. Let him go over. Let him get the pin on Jericho here and set up the rematch between the two. So that's what Full Gear is looking like to me. And then Omega and Ospreay, that's probably all set for the Tokyo Dome, would be my guess. And according to Darby Allin, during their countdown special that aired on Friday night, his match with Christian Cage will be main eventing WrestleDream tonight. Darby said that he's waited to be in the main event of an AEW pay-per-view for so long. It will be Darby challenging the new TNT champion, Christian Cage, for the title in a 2 out of 3 falls match. Now, I'm thinking back now to the Pillars. Right, the Pillars of AEW. Who are the Pillars? MJF, Darby Allin, Jack Perry, and Sammy Guevara. Right? Didn't they had a 4-way match, I think, back at Double or Nothing? And I'm pretty sure all but Jack Perry have now, as of tonight, assuming that Darby goes on last, all four of them will have main evented, or I'm sorry, 3 out of 4 will have main evented an AEW pay-per-view. Right? MJF has headlined. Sammy has been a part of some multi-man matches, like the Stadium Stampede stuff. And if Darby goes on last with Christian tonight, that only leaves Jungle Boy, who, as far as we know, is still indefinitely suspended. So it looks like old Jack Perry over there is the only one without a main event to his name. But this will be for the TNT Championship. 2 out of 3 falls. For Christian, it will be his second time headlining an AEW pay-per-view after his match with Kenny Omega 2 years ago at Full Gear. That was the same night that Adam Cole and Bryan Danielson made their debuts. They aired a great sit-down interview with Jim Ross on Dynamite Wednesday with Darby and Christian, where Darby told him not to bring Luchasaurus to the ring. Now, that doesn't mean that Christian has to listen to this guy. He's a heel. And Luchasaurus is going to be there, right? He's wrestling on 0 hour. But the idea is no Nick Wayne, no Luchasaurus at ringside for this match. It's going to be 1-on-1, fair fight, 2 out of 3 falls. Darby beat Samoa Joe to win the TNT title back on the very first Dynamite of the year in this same building in his hometown of Seattle. That and the fact that they are headlining with this, I would say, of course, Darby Allin is going to win back the TNT championship. Were it not for the fact that he has said he is headed to Switzerland this month and China next month to begin training for his Mount Everest climb in April. So it doesn't mean he's going to be overseas the entire month, but if he's going to be gone for more than just a few days, there's no point in putting the title on him. Why would you even bother doing the title change if he's not going to be around? But there's another reason why I think Christian is retaining, and it is the big story that everybody is talking about. Christian said he doesn't need Luchasaurus to beat Darby Allin. Today just so happens to be the first day of October. It's the first day that Christian's best friend and former tag team partner Edge is officially a free agent. His WWE deal expired yesterday, meaning he is now free to sign with whoever he wants, or no one at all. They even took him out of the SmackDown intro on Friday. PW Insider confirmed he was removed from WWE's miscellaneous internal roster, although he would be anyway if his contract expired. His last match was the win over Sheamus in Toronto on SmackDown. Apparently Sheamus, he hurt his shoulder pretty badly in that match. That's why we haven't seen him since. We haven't seen either one of them since. But that match was an excellent match, and it's not a bad way to go out if that was going to be Edge's final match. But I don't believe that it is. Whether it's WWE, AEW, I don't believe that Edge has wrestled his final match. And there has been a lot of talk that even people in WWE have believed for weeks, not just this week, but for weeks, that Edge is going to AEW. There is a reason that this match is going on last. Now, it could be just as simple as Darby is a Seattle guy and he's going to win the title. And Tony Khan wants to give him a big moment and give the fans a happy ending. And I'll say this, if this match does end up going on last, and again, they flat out said that it would, so unless there's a change in plans, this is going on last. What I like about that, the TNT title has been neglected for so long, and you've heard me talk about this a lot on this show. The TNT Championship used to be something you would look at. It wasn't just a secondary title. It was a title that had actual value to it. When Cody had it and Darby had it the first time, Miro won it, and there were different people who held it, but it was really a title that was held in high regard in AEW. Then along came the All-Atlantic title, which seemed like overkill. What the hell do we need an All-Atlantic title for? Eventually, they rebranded it. Now it's the International title. And what has happened over the course of the past year, and it really started around the time when Wardlow got the belt, and it went from, like, Wardlow had it, and Scorpio Sky had it, and it just, the booking of the TNT Championship went to shit. Probably around the time that Wardlow's booking went to shit, coincidentally. But it's almost like the script flipped. And I don't care what you think of Orange Cassidy, you may hate his guts and think that he's a pox on the wrestling business. The booking of Orange Cassidy as the international champion elevated the international title far above the TNT title. It's like the roles reversed. We were seeing that championship defended on television almost every week on a regular basis. He was welcoming all comers and he was having some pretty damn good matches with a lot of these people. The TNT title became a complete afterthought. And so now it looks like maybe nature is healing. Because it looks like the TNT Championship might actually be headlining a pay-per-view. When was the last time that happened? All right, this may be the first time. But it's either the first time or the first time in a very long time. So I'm happy to see them actually doing something and positioning the TNT title in a way where it actually feels valuable. You know, for the first time in a very long time. So it is possible. That's as simple as it is. Tony Khan is going to put Darby Allin over, and it's going to be the big feel-good moment to end the show in his hometown. But I think they're headlining for a different reason. I think it's because Edge is going to make his AEW debut. He won't be able to call himself Edge. He can call himself Sledge or Wedge or whatever he wants, but I don't think he owns the rights to Edge. You know, Roderick Strong is already going around every week yelling, Adam, at the top of his lungs, so that might be a little weird, but Adam might just be the way to go. If Tony Khan wants to get people talking, he wants to have a big moment to close out this show. Boy, he's sure hyping this show up in a very big way, like something big is going down tonight. That would be one way of doing it. That would be one way of closing the show. By having Edge either cost Christian the title and help Darby go up 2-1 to win the title, and we can get Edge against Christian, or he helps Christian win. And that's the way that I think it's going to go. Christian said he'll leave Luchasaurus behind, but he never said anything about his best friend. There's money in one last Edge and Christian run together. They could do some tag matches. They could still wrestle singles, right? They're not going to be full-time singles wrestlers, but they could still do singles matches. You get those tag matches out of the way before you do any kind of split and have them wrestle each other. I mean, you know, Edge is a bit of a weird case. There were some matches of his in this latest run with WWE that I really liked. Like the last one he had. And there were some matches that just absolutely bored me. It's not that I wouldn't sit here and tell you, oh, Edge is washed. Like, there are some people I'll look at and go, okay, that guy's washed. I don't look at Edge and go, okay, he's washed. He can't go anymore. But age has caught up with him, right? He was out of the ring for so long, didn't take bumps or anything. Then he comes back after 9 years. That's a tough thing to do for your body to readjust. But now he's been back for 3 years or 3.5 years. And I don't know how old he is, right? If he's 50 or he's closing in on 50. But age has caught up with him, as it will with all of us. Age has caught up with him. I don't think he has another 3 years left in him full-time. Part-time, sure. He could go a couple of matches each year or something like that for the next 5 if he wants to. And Tony Khan sees value in that. It's why he wanted Edge back. Look, Tony Khan brought Sting in. Sting was more of a marquee name to a lot of people than Edge was, because just because Sting has been in the business for so much longer. And Edge was out for 9 years. Sting never left. Sting has been around since fucking 1985 or whatever it was. In various promotions, he never retired. He never really went away. You know, Edge disappeared for 9 years. So Tony Khan saw Sting. He probably marked out for him. He probably was a huge Sting mark as a wrestling fan and said, boy, I'd love to work with him. And imagine the money I can make with him in licensing and put him in our video game eventually and all this different stuff. It was a smart play. And I will say that Tony Khan, forget the dumb risks that, you know, he let Sting take at a lot of these matches. I feel like he's going to kill himself in the ring one day. But the booking of Sting, the way that he has handled Sting has been just picture perfect. And I applaud him for that. He found a way to use Sting in the best way possible. Sting is not in a position where he should be wrestling for a world title. Unless it's his final match and there's a story they want to tell there. It's not like he's putting Sting in singles matches. He's going over on all their top stars and squashing people. He's been very deliberate in the way that he has used him in this alliance, this partnership, this tag team with Darby Allin. It's been very smart, but he saw the value in Sting. And I think likewise, Tony Khan recognizes the value in Edge. And we know he sees value in him because it goes all the way back to 2019 when he tried to get him. He made him an offer. He wanted him in as a wrestler and as somebody who could assist behind the scenes. That's when Edge went to Vince McMahon out of loyalty and said, look, I just want you to know I got this offer here. And Vince was like, oh, if you're going to come back, you know, you're going to wrestle for us. You're not going to wrestle for somebody else. And good for Edge. He got a fucking sweetheart deal out of it. Edge brings value to AEW as more than just an in-ring performer. He can still talk, right? His mouth can still move. He's a great promo. He's a big name they can use, you know, publicly that wrestling fans, even lapsed fans, would recognize from years ago, even if they don't watch wrestling anymore, right? They know who Edge is from the Attitude Era in the early 2000s, so there's value in him in that regard. He could be a great asset as a coach or a mentor to some of the younger talents. He's just a great veteran presence to have around. And if you don't think there isn't value in Edge and Christian working together one last time, that's a very stupid thing to think. And of course, I'm sure Tony Khan would love to put together one last Edge and Christian match against the Hardys. The Hardys are a different story. They have seen better days in the ring. But Christian is doing some of the best work of his entire career right now. Christian is fantastic. I'm enjoying what he is doing now more than what Edge was doing in WWE. I would take this Christian run in AEW over this latest Edge run in WWE. But, you know, you think about the possibilities here. What about Edge and Christian against Darby Allin and Sting at some point? All right, that would be a hell of a retirement match for Sting. So does Tony Khan need Edge? No, he doesn't need Edge. Nor does Edge need Tony Khan. But I think they both recognize the value in working together. Edge can still make great money. It's not like he's going to be fucking poor working for one billionaire over another. He's going to make great money. He gets to work with his best friend. And now he has a whole new roster of talent that he could work with. You know, think about the Judgment Day. The Judgment Day was his idea. He wanted to work with Damian Priest. He wanted to help elevate Rhea Ripley. It ended prematurely for him, but replacing him with Finn Balor, it took that group to the next level, and look at them now. They're the top faction in the company. The Judgment Day has done wonders for all four of them. But it started out as an Edge idea. That's where he can bring real value to AEW. And with CM Punk gone, if Tony Khan wants to give Collision a boost, you know, now it's the Bryan Danielson show. Adding Edge to that show, or Edge and Christian, would add some more star power to the show. If he feels like, oh, well, we took a bit of a hit with Punk being gone. Punk was the big name. Well, that would certainly help. You know, featuring them more on the Saturday show. I really didn't think that Edge would make the move. And I still won't believe it until I see it. But I was one who thought, you know, at the end of all this, I hear the rumors and everything, but I said this even a few weeks ago. I said, at the end of the day, I think he'll still stick with WWE. But the chatter about him going to AEW has really picked up in the last couple of weeks. And the timing of this show could not have lined up any better for Tony Khan. Maybe it happens tonight. Maybe it doesn't happen until Wednesday. Maybe it doesn't happen at all. And this is all just a lot of fantasy booking. But that's how I think Wrestle Dream is going to end. So that's 14 matches. I guess I'll be seeing you guys at 2 o'clock in the morning, live on YouTube for the review. For Wrestle Dream, it'll be a miracle if I'm not dreaming before the main event even hits the ring. Now, a couple of other AEW news and notes. We got a health update from Malakai Black this week on his Instagram stories. We have not seen Malakai in the ring since the House of Black dropped the Trios titles to the Acclaimed at All In at Wembley. So he popped over on Wednesday morning on Instagram and he revealed that he has been dealing with a slight calf tear and a hyperextended knee. And he also shot down rumors about his back because, of course, he had a previous back injury that he talked about publicly and indicated that that actually has nothing to do with the reason that we haven't seen him. He says, "About a year ago, I made a video about rehabbing a back injury that I had. The video shows the process, and I talk about overcoming that injury and strengthening my back. After the video was posted, people started running with this idea that, oh, he has a bad back, and therefore A, B, or C, which is not the case at all. And for some reason, that has found its way back. And again, this narrative is, well, he's not had singles matches, etc., because he has a bad back, and he nearly retired because of it. And none of these things are true. Why am I not having singles matches? I don't know. I think it's because they really wanted us, the House of Black, to do six-mans. I was also not in six-mans to hide said non-existing injury. Again, rest assured I do not have a bad back, and the reason why I am at home right now is due to a minor injury, which is I had a slight calf tear and hyperextension in my knee, which is almost nursed back and almost ready to go back on the road. Again, I appreciate the concern, but the reality is I am fine, and you will see me sooner rather than later, but again, I appreciate the concern." So it's very telling to me that he mentions the fact that, why am I not doing singles matches? I don't know. Because that's one of the things that I've talked about. It's one thing to do trios matches with the House of Black, but that doesn't mean that you can't have Malakai Black and Brody King doing singles. And I can't remember the last time we saw Malakai Black in a singles match. It just doesn't happen. So naturally, people would think, okay, maybe there's an injury reason for it. And basically what he's saying there is, no, I don't know. I'm not the person to ask. You have concerns about that? Ask somebody else. I don't have any control over that. It has nothing to do with my health. It has nothing to do with my back. It has nothing to do with something that he personally requested. I just want to do trios. So we did learn that. He made that very clear that it's not his call. That's a Tony Khan thing. Whatever his rationale is for it. And I hope that once we start seeing Malakai back on TV, we can get him in singles matches. You know, we can see him in the ring on Collision with Andrade and all the other, you know, members of the roster, because there's so many people for him to work with that it's just crazy that he has been contained to trios matches. And I feel like, you know, in that regard, he's done all he can do, right? They've won the trios titles. They've lost the trios titles. For them to just go back after them would be fucking pointless. So let's start getting him back in the ring in singles matches, because even according to him, there's really no logical reason for it. Now, Ricky Steamboat, let's talk about Ricky the Dragon Steamboat briefly. I mentioned this many, many, many weeks ago on the podcast after the episode of Collision where Ricky first showed up and he got beaten down by Ricky Starks. But he commented on this again to Bill Apter in an interview that he gave him. He talked about the original creative plans that AEW had for him in fighting off Ricky Starks. And he said they suggested an outcome that, if you remember, this is when Steamboat was announced as the guest referee for the real world title match on Collision between CM Punk and Ricky Starks. I want to say it was the same night as SummerSlam. So this would have been the very beginning of August. He said they suggested an outcome that I didn't like. I said, "Look, you're doing a slow turn with this kid, Ricky Starks, and trying to turn him heel. And what you're suggesting, there's not going to be any heat on him." So I made the suggestion of what everybody saw. And I said, "I'd like to put some heat on this kid. I was glad to do what I was able to do to help pass the torch and put some heat on Ricky Starks. I wanted to get some heat on this kid, and they had a result where everything would go down as it was, and then as he would spin me around and try to take a shot, I would block it and give him some big chops, and he would take a bump through the ropes to the floor and scurry up the ramp. It would be a happy moment, and I'm thinking, well, where's the heat? Where's the heat for this kid? Plus the fact that I'm 70, and they're going to say, God, Stark's a 70-year-old timer just whooped on you. I said, we got to turn this around to where he's got to catch me off guard and sucker me and get me down and do something to where it's almost to the point of disgusting and shameful. And that, my friends, is why Ricky Steamboat has a good mind for the wrestling business. Shocker, I know. I think Ricky Steamboat made the right call on that one, because what they ended up doing was far better than Ricky Starks getting knocked out of the ring and running away from Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. So, hat tip to Ricky Steamboat. He's somebody that clearly they could use in AEW as a sounding board or an agent or something, because that idea is a hell of a lot better than what they were going to do in the first place. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you ever find yourself overthinking things? Like your brain is racing with all kinds of thoughts and you just can't really focus on the task at hand? It could be about a big purchase you're about to make, like a house or a car or something involving a family member. Like, you know what you should do, but you just can't bring yourself to actually do it. Therapy can help you figure out what's holding you back and get your brain working for you, not against you. Therapy has a lot of potential benefits, and it can help you be the best version of you that you want to be. It's not just for people that have been through an emotional trauma in their lives. If you've been thinking about giving it a try, might I suggest BetterHelp? It's online, it's convenient, and it's suited to whatever your schedule may be. You don't need to worry about getting in your car and driving to an office and then sitting in a waiting room. You can do it all from the comfort of your own home. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. You have nothing to lose, but so much to gain. Make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Solomonster today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. A lot of people have been taking advantage of that 10% off, so make sure you do too. The Jade Cargill story blew wide open this week. WWE fed the news of her signing to ESPN and let them break the news, which tells you a lot about what they think about her. And the story on ESPN.com says, Jade Cargill, a rising star in professional wrestling and former champion in All Elite Wrestling, has signed with WWE, promotion officials told ESPN. Cargill, who was AEW's longest-reigning TBS champion and appeared on television as recently as 2 weeks ago, will start with the WWE on Tuesday at its Performance Center in Orlando. It remains unclear if Cargill will go straight to the main roster or if she will first perform for its developmental brand, NXT. Cargill has been performing professionally for only 2 years. Her in-ring debut came in AEW as part of a high-profile mixed tag team match in March of 2021. She teamed with NBA legend Shaquille O'Neal against Cody Rhodes and Red Velvet. Rhodes, one of her mentors at his Nightmare Factory in Georgia, signed with WWE last year after helping found AEW in 2019, and headlined WrestleMania 39. Cargill was the first AEW TBS champion and held the title for a span of 508 days. And then they had Jade making the rounds, and she did an interview with Mark Raimondi of ESPN. And in the interview, she said that she already knows which brand she's going to, but she would not tell us which. She said, everybody is going to have to tune in to every network to see where I'm going. I'm here to stir the pot and keep people guessing where I am going to be, so just tune in. And on why she signed with WWE, she said, the leadership. I mean, Paul, Bruce, talking about Paul Levesque, Bruce Pritchard, Dan Ventrell, and Nick Khan. You can't get any better than that, and I'm the first signing under the TKO umbrella. So there's so many different things. Where else can you go to get the best quality training? Nowhere else. The PC here is one of one. There's nothing else like it. The machine is behind you, the platform, just the overall history, the legacy. I'm creating a household name. I can go on and on. I mean, why not? The question more so is why not? I worked with Daniel Bryan, a phenomenal guy, but he came here. So I thought that this is a no-brainer. I thought I couldn't get any better as far as in the ring than to come here and join a mega company. Oh, did that get some people upset. But there's nothing in her statement that was wrong. I mean, look, what else would you expect her to say? All right, she's the big new marquee signing. She's the big shiny new toy. And she knows how to play the game. She knows all the right things to say. She's going to build herself up as much as possible and put WWE over as much as possible. It's not that she's trying to slight AEW, although there's a lot of fans who took it that way. But the fact is that they are the big company. It's just a fact. WWE is the biggest wrestling promotion in the world. Whether you think it's the best, whether you think it's the worst, whether you think AEW is number one, that's your opinion. But there's nothing she said in those statements that is false. Now, she talked to The Ringer as well. And when she was asked about her connection with Cody Rhodes, did that affect her decision? She confirmed that it did. She said, he was top three and not third. He is a phenomenal man. I have seen what the business did for him. I've seen him just be the stellar athlete that he is. And I didn't see any different for myself. And I don't think that the Cody influence can really be stressed enough here. That he was the first big defection from AEW. And what made it even worse, I guess you would say, for AEW is the fact that he was one of the VPs, the EVPs in the company. He was the first EVP to make the jump. So he wasn't just an AEW talent and one of their biggest names. He helped found the company. And then he left to go back to WWE. And he made a lot of friends in AEW. He still has a lot of friends in AEW. And I guarantee you, he's texting people. He's talking to them. We saw Ricky Starks got caught on the security cameras coming in with him for the Royal Rumble earlier this year. That was a whole big controversy, much ado about nothing. So you know he's talking to Starks. You know he's talking to MJF. You know he's talking to Jade. He's talking to all these people. And I'm not saying that Cody is trying to stir shit and say, hey, you gotta come here. He's trying to fucking, you know, recruit half the roster. But he is a great sounding board for a lot of these people who can get in touch and call him and text him and say, hey, look, you know, my contract is coming due, or, you know, I'm thinking about making a move. What do you think? How is it over there? How are they treating you? What should I be aware of? What are the pros and cons? That's another reason why his signing was such a huge blow to Tony Khan. It's not just looking at it as, okay, they lost a big talent. They have a lot of talent already. Just purely from a talent perspective, yes, losing Cody Rhodes was a blow, but they got over that very quickly. Because they lost Cody Rhodes, but guess what? They still have Kenny Omega, and they still have all of these different people that they have under contract on that roster. They had Punk, they have Danielson, they have Moxley, they have Claudio, they have a lot of young talents, whether it be MJF, Ricky Starks, they got Adam Cole, they got all these people, veterans, Samoa Joe, Sting, Christian. Talent is not the issue. They have an overabundance of talent in AEW. It's the influence that Cody has that, you know, him coming over to WWE, it gives all these other people when they're thinking about maybe making the jump an insight that they wouldn't otherwise have. And all they need to do, honestly, is just look at the way Cody's been booked since Vince McMahon brought him in. He's been a top star since day one. They've actually treated him very well. Now, you can argue he should have won the title or not won the title at WrestleMania. That's beside the point. He's going to win the WWE Championship at some point. He's going to be in a marquee match, whether it's the main event or not, at WrestleMania next year. He was in the main event of WrestleMania this year. You know, he beat Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar shook his hand and raised his arm and put him over at the end of their feud. Cody's a big deal in WWE. There are still some people trying to convince themselves that he's not, which just is laughable to me. All you got to do is put your fucking TV on and turn the volume up when he comes out on TV every week. So that really is where it was a huge blow for AEW. Because, you know, Jade was one of those people who said, hey, look, you know, I'm thinking I might want to make a move. What do you think? And I'm sure whatever he told her, whatever his advice was, probably had a very big influence on her decision to leave. Now, I've been saying that I think it would be smart for her to spend some time in NXT first. I know it's probably not going to happen, and it's going to be very appealing for them to just rocket her right to Raw or SmackDown. and they're probably paying her good money and they don't want her just languishing in NXT for too long. But I still think, look, she's very inexperienced. She's made progress. She's better now than she was 2 years ago, but they said it in the article. She only debuted in 2021. And it's great that she had the one-on-one time behind the scenes with Bryan Danielson. I can't think of a better person to learn from. But she's never had that formal, proper training and able to get in the ring and in a system like they have down there. They have their own system. It almost doesn't even matter if she did go from place to place, because they're going to want to, you know, mold her and shape her in the way of a WWE superstar, right? She's going to have to conform to the way they do things down there. She has to spend some time in NXT. And I'm not the only one who feels that way. We had Mickie James on Busted Open Radio this week echoing exactly what I've been saying. She said, I think it would benefit her greatly to spend some time in that system because she has learned on TV. She has learned on AEW TV. There are two different locker rooms. They're ran two different ways. The companies are run two entirely different ways. It's like going from here in the U.S. to wrestling in Japan. A lot of people need to spend some time, work, the dojos, all that stuff before they just go over and become a star because it's different. Apples and oranges, two different things. But we already hear that main roster creative is being prepared for her. She knows what brand she's going to go to. I pitched the idea last week. Becky Lynch is walking around the NXT Women's Champion still after last night. And if you want to make a big splash with Jade Cargill, but still connect her in some way to NXT where she can still spend some time down there on that brand at the PC, one way to do it would be to introduce her as a surprise challenger for Becky in the NXT Women's Championship. Becky's going to be going through people. She wrestled Natty. Now she's going to wrestle Tegan Nox on Raw tomorrow night if she gets cleared because she hurt her arm last night, has a gash on it. But she may blow through a few other challengers that she might want to work with. And then 1 week, Jade Cargill shows up. And Jade could beat Becky Lynch. Becky wants to help create this new star, this new big star in the women's division. She could very well put Jade over. Jade wins the NXT Women's Championship. Doesn't mean she can't still show up on Raw or SmackDown, but it would force them to use her in NXT as well, and she can spend some time down there and still end up, you know, being in the Women's Royal Rumble in January or maybe even having a match at WrestleMania. But I think it would be a mistake not to let her spend some time down there. She's still a Green Hornet. She's still new to all this. She's not great in the ring. She could one day be great in the ring, but she's not yet. So it may end up being baptism by fire where they just think, okay, well, we'll let her work with the Becky Lynches and the Charlottes and the Baileys on the main roster and she'll learn that way and on the live events. But I still think that she would benefit from spending some time as a big fish in a small pond. Because even just being a big fish in a small pond for a while in NXT just makes her feel like such a bigger star. That's not such a bad thing either. Let her work all the shows. Now, one idea also is that, you know, they could potentially be doing here, and I think this could be a fucking disaster, but, you know, they're building Nia Jax up on Raw as this monster. She's squashing, literally squashing everybody on the roster, going through everybody. I'm sure Rhea Ripley is going to be back this week. Maybe they'll go right to a Rhea Ripley-Nia Jax match, and Rhea will just beat her, and that'll be the end of it. But if they're beating all these people, if Nia is beating up all these people and she's booked like this unstoppable force, you could have Jade debut randomly on Raw one night and she could, you know, pick her up and she could slam her. I mean, that's one thing they could do. But if the idea would be to work a match and have Jade Cargill against Nia Jax, that would just be a fucking disaster. I'm sorry. So I know that's another idea that's been talked about, but my God, I'm just trying to envision what that would look like. I'm not even worried so much about, like, Jade on her own. It's just that Jade in the ring with somebody like Nia, not exactly a ring general, I think that would be a big mistake. And before I get to NXT, I want to talk about Fastlane, because it occurred to me that there is another pay-per-view taking place before the next podcast, because we have WrestleDream tonight, as I am recording this, but then next Saturday is Fastlane. So I want to just run through the card as it stands. Now, this cannot be the complete card. Four matches official so far. I'm sure they're going to add at least two more, maybe three, on television this week. But here's what we have announced so far. Seth Rollins is going to defend the World Heavyweight title in a last man standing match against Shinsuke Nakamura. So the story of this match is going to be the bad back on Seth Rollins. Can he make it back to his feet in time for the 10 count? If not, Nakamura would win the championship. Nakamura is not going to win the championship. But that's going to be the dramatic story they play up during the match. I am not discounting the possibility, though, that there could be a Money in the Bank cash-in attempt by Damian Priest on this show. But Seth Rollins is going to retain the World Heavyweight title. John Cena had no tag team partner before Friday night. It was going to be a handicap match. AJ Styles got taken out by the Bloodline last week on SmackDown. It was going to be Solo Sikoa and Jimmy Uso against John Cena, 2-1. But we knew it wasn't going to be that way. LA Knight made his return on Friday night. He signed the contract. John Cena has a tag team partner. So it will be John Cena and LA Knight taking on Jimmy Uso and Solo Sikoa. And that reaction when LA Knight came out on Friday night, that was a megastar reaction. So, again, this crowd missed him for 1 week. He wasn't on SmackDown the week prior because, you know, he got popped for COVID. They sent him home, so they had to readjust what they were going to do to set the match up. It actually worked out a lot better because it allowed them to create this entire show-long story on Friday where the Bloodline was beating up everybody who they thought might be tag team partners with John Cena, which is hilarious to think about because one of the people they beat up was Ashanti the Adonis. As if John Cena was going to go to fucking Hit Row and say, hey, can I borrow Ashanti for one match here? Would you be my tag team partner, Ashanti? Yeah, poor Ashanti, he got put through a table by Solo Sikoa. So I guess, unfortunately, he missed his chance. But they had LA Knight out at the end of the show. And again, he helped take out the Bloodline. And he's just treated like a top guy. And somebody put a side-by-side video comparison together on Twitter of the reaction to him when he first came out as LA Knight on television on SmackDown last year, almost a year ago to the day, as compared to the reaction he got on Friday night. And it's amazing the difference a year can make. Even then, you could feel it. You could feel there was something there. All they had to do was just find the right story for him, just to pull it out. But the fans were ready to get behind this guy. But they have gotten behind him in a very big way. And I think, you know, I look at this match and we know Roman Reigns is on his way back October 13th. He's supposed to be on SmackDown that night. I think Jimmy Uso is going to be the one to eat the pin. He's going to take the loss for his team or cause the loss, take the loss. It's going to all fall on Jimmy when he gets beaten by LA Knight. And that's going to, it's like waking up the fucking Kraken and Roman Reigns will return. That's the Friday after Fastlane. He'll be back on television to probably read Jimmy the Riot Act. But it looks like we're in for a Roman Reigns LA Knight match, whether it's in Saudi Arabia, whether it's at Survivor Series. This is the path that they seem to be on. AJ Styles is out with the storyline injury. I look ahead and say, okay, I think Roman AJ is the match to do at Crown Jewel. But we're probably going to get Roman and LA Knight at Survivor Series. John Cena, we only have him until the Saudi show. So he's on SmackDown through the end of this month. It looks like he'll be in Saudi Arabia on November 4th. At that point, he's done. He has fulfilled all of his obligations at that point. And then it's all on LA Knight. He becomes the top babyface on SmackDown. Io Sky is going to defend her WWE Women's Championship at Fastlane in a triple threat match against Charlotte Flair and Asuka. Of course, Charlotte, you know, cashes in her Charlotte in the Bank, so she's back in the title match. Asuka gets a rematch. Bayley looks like she might be trying to cost Io the title here. Charlotte had some unkind words for Bayley on Friday, being a follower, you're a stepping stone, what happened to you? It's all about Io now. And it was Bayley who accepted the challenge on Io's behalf. And Io did not seem very happy about that. I don't think Io's dropping the title yet, though. I'm hoping and expecting that Io Sky is going to retain her championship. The match itself may end up being very good, but just I can't stomach the idea of another Charlotte Flair title match here on paper. It's like, you know? I mean, come on. Who could get excited about this at this point? And a six-man tag team match is now official. It will be the newly turned Street Profits. We saw the heel turn on Friday night, finally. The Street Profits and Bobby Lashley are going to be taking on the LWO. They have not specified which three members of the LWO it is going to be. I have to assume it'll be Escobar with Joaquin Wilde and Cruz del Toro. Rey will probably not be in the match, but be in their corner. That would be my guess, but they have not specified. And that should be a win for Bobby Lashley and the Street Profits. I mean, you just turned them on Friday, right? They're finally, they've aligned, the stars have aligned for these three now. And they go in there and they lose to the LWO. Give me a break. Of course they're going to win. They have to win. They should win. Now, as far as the other matches that could be added to the show, it all depends on how many Triple H wants on this card. So that's four. And I'm guessing they're going to want to keep it to six. But they could do seven. Rhea Ripley should be back on television this week. She's been over in Australia with Buddy Matthews, which is why Buddy has not been on AEW television. I'm expecting her back this week. If she's back, I don't know why she wouldn't throw out the challenge to Nia Jax. Not that I'm dying to see that match. But I could see Rhea against Nia being added to the show. In which case, Rhea Ripley wins. No other outcome is acceptable other than Rhea Ripley wins. Cody Rhodes doesn't have a match, but there's a lot of people who don't have matches. And based on what they've been doing on TV, I think what we'll end up with is an eight-man tag. I think it's going to be Cody, Jey Uso, Sami Zayn, and Kevin Owens against Finn Balor, Damian Priest, Dominic Mysterio, and JD McDonagh. And I think they do just the straight eight-man tag, and this will end up being a prelude to a War Games match with those same four at Survivor Series. That's my guess there. If they do the eight-man tag at Fastlane, I think you give the win to the Judgment Day. I think there's something that happens involving Owens and Jey Uso, and there's a falling out or a miscommunication or something. It cost them the match. There's got to be a reason to run it back if they're going to run it back and do it in a War Games format. So if they do that match, I'm going with the Judgment Day for the win. Not that they can't do the exact same thing with the Judgment Day, right? And have issues with JD McDonagh and Damian Priest. But I think the heels would go over if they do it. And then the only other match I am looking at this card and saying, okay, are they going to add this to the pay-per-view would be Gunther and Tommaso Ciampa. They're having a contract signing on Raw tomorrow night for a future Intercontinental title match. That's all they've said. It's a future title match. They have not said when. They did Gunther and Gable on Raw. They could very well do Gunther and Ciampa on Raw next Monday. If they add it to the pay-per-view, though, I mean, Gunther, I mean, look, I don't think anybody believes that Ciampa is going to be the one to dethrone Gunther at Fastlane. You still got that Chad Gable story that they keep mentioning. Right? Gable's coming. Gable keeps reminding us, I'm coming for that championship. It's just, do they do it at Fastlane? Do they do it on Raw? It doesn't matter. Wherever they do it, Gunther wins. NXT held its first No Mercy event last night on the road in Bakersfield, and it was a fun show overall. Very, very good show. Those last two matches were outstanding. The NXT Championship match, in particular, between Carmelo Hayes and Ilya Dragunov, I know how good both of these men are, and they both absolutely brought it last night. But Ilya Dragunov, man, you know, that guy is a special, special talent. Doesn't matter if you're, you know, green like Trick Williams or if you're a veteran like Walter. Anyone that he is in the ring with, anyone I've ever seen him in the ring with, he automatically elevates their game. Dragunov is now the face of NXT, and I could not be happier for him. He had outgrown NXT UK, and because WWE wasn't ready to launch NXT Europe, and instead of him being stuck over there for another few years, he got a chance to shine on the main NXT brand, and he has knocked it out of the park. And he will do the same when he eventually gets called up to the main roster, which he will. And one day, mark my words, we will once again get Gunther and Ilya Dragunov. Only this time, it'll be on a WWE pay-per-view. Probably for a championship. Not in an empty BT Sports studio with no fans, or in the Performance Center, like their last match. It'll be in front of 15,000 people or 50,000 people in a stadium. And they will have the people on their feet. It is happening one day. But before I get into the rest of my No Mercy thoughts, Shawn Michaels, on the media call this week, was asked about the Mustafa Ali and Dana Brooke releases. On Ali, he said, "I think the world of Mustafa. He had a great working relationship with him in the time that he was here. I will miss him. That's what we do here in NXT. We adjust. The fire drill is something that is a regular thing here in WWE and certainly here at NXT. I feel like someone pulled the fire alarm the minute that Vince McMahon fucking worked his way back onto the fucking board of directors. That was a 5-alarm fire in Titan Tower over there. He said, I feel we made a great pivot. We adjusted. And he's an unbelievably creative and talented young man, and no doubt his future looks incredibly bright, and he will be successful. I am going to miss him, and I enjoy working with him for the time that I did have him here. Now, Trick Williams is the beneficiary of that, and he has the biggest match of his life at No Mercy." Shawn Michaels was said to be caught off guard, like a lot of people, pretty much everybody was, in NXT, and was not very happy. Not only that they got rid of Ali, but again, not to get a heads up or anything. I mean, they don't even tell the people there, like, hey, look, we have a list. This is, you know, what the list looks like. These are the people that you need to be aware of. Just to give them a heads up. Nothing. They just make the cuts, and he finds out like everybody else. He probably went on Twitter and found out. I may have known before Shawn Michaels did, and that's sad. Now, on Dana Brooke, he said, "Dana is something that caught us by surprise a little bit because we had a nice story going on there. I hope this doesn't sound insensitive. This is not the first time that we've gone through this. It is something that I will say this, in my world now, maybe I've grown a little bit. You know, these things don't throw me into chaos and I don't get too nervous or too upset. We're trying not to let the highs take us too high or the lows take us down too low. We've made adjustments. The talent that come from the main roster, I just enjoy my time with them. I really do. I feel like we give them a love and a passion back for this line of work." Boy, is that a backhanded compliment, huh? What does that say about the way things are done up on the main roster? We give them back their passion that they've lost. Anyway, he says, those would be the two we had the deepest storylines down here with. Those are always times you have to make adjustments creatively. And we have done that in the case of Ali, and we're going to do that in the case of Dana. Now, he was also asked about the possibility. I can't even believe I'm talking about this, but he was asked about the possibility of CM Punk being included in the NXT mix. Of course, it was fucking Housman who asked the question. Nick Housman. Yes, I'm sure that's exactly where they would put CM Punk if they brought him back. Is in the Performance Center. Michael said, "I always enjoy working with Phil. Again, I didn't get to do it much, but I don't know. I'll say this. I understood him. I think he saved his job. You know that story from way back in the day. I think there were, whether you want to say there were similarities in us, look, I can't lie, he, once again, we were at TV, and he once pulled out of his wallet right there on the spot a little autograph that I guess I apparently signed for him in a hotel that he still had. So, I've always liked him, and I understand he's a different kind of cat and can sometimes be challenging to get along with, but, again, that's probably why I like him, because I suffer from the same thing. So, still, obviously, that's for people to decide higher up on the food chain than I am. He's a guy that does numbers and makes money. I think that would be a risk-reward ratio that I'm sure from a company standpoint they'll have to consider. But when it comes to would we take him in NXT and have him on our television, are you kidding me? Of course I would. I just don't think anybody would let me." At least he got the quote that he was looking for. But that's one of the more ridiculous questions I've heard on these media calls. If WWE brings back CM Punk, would you want him in NXT? Hey, look, the way that they've been putting main roster talent on NXT, I can't even sit here and tell you that it's impossible to conceive of, that if he came back to the company, he wouldn't eventually land on NXT if he wanted to work with some of the younger talents. But that is not how WWE would be utilizing CM Punk if they brought him back. Now, Michaels also made this comment, which got people talking. He compared current era NXT with the Attitude Era. Of course, that got a lot of people's undies in a bunch, but this is what he said. "I feel like NXT has got a buzz right now, and I feel like we are the hottest thing going in the wrestling business. We have a fun show, ours is the closest thing to the Attitude Era that you're going to get. And I know a lot of people want to roll their eyes at that, but we have had Wild West stuff going on, and there's always something new happening. It's very different. We have a number of different reasons for being in storylines. If you ask me, every other show out there, they all wrestle each other because they're all angry at each other. I'm angry at this guy. We're going to fight about it. If you watch NXT, there are different reasons and stakes on why people get into wrestling matches on our show. I'm very proud of our show and what we have accomplished over the last several months. That was the whole basis for the spark of the Attitude Era, is that everybody was angry at each other. Everybody was walking around all pissed off. Bret Hart was pissed off, Shawn Michaels was pissed off, Sid was pissed off, Undertaker was pissed off, Stone Cold, I mean, he walked around for his whole fucking run there pissed off. Everybody was upset with each other. Everybody wanted the championship. That's where I trace back the roots of the Attitude Era. And then, you know, Russo filled in all the gaps and gave stories to everybody, and that's what it became in 98 and 99. But that was really the genesis of the Attitude Era. So now he is saying that NXT is the hottest thing going in the wrestling business. They've had this great infusion of main roster talent. So the numbers have been up. The numbers for NXT are elevated. Becky Lynch, a few weeks ago, they did over 1 million viewers for the overrun of the show, I think, where she wrestled Tiffany Stratton. So to that end, there is a buzz right now around NXT that wasn't there before, because you have the influence of people like her putting her on the show. We have NXT championships being defended on Raw and SmackDown, and Dominic up until this weekend had the North American title. So that's true. Now, is NXT the hottest thing going in the wrestling business? No. No, it is not. But I don't fault Shawn Michaels for saying that it is, right? Tony Khan goes out there every week and says AEW is the best. I wouldn't expect Tony Khan to go out there and say AEW is the second best. AEW is the third best. You know, AEW's okay, but there's room for improvement. No, he goes out there and he is the biggest cheerleader for his brand that he can possibly be. That's what Shawn Michaels is for NXT. And every time I see Shawn Michaels in one of these videos, you know, backstage, the talent comes to the back, he looks like a proud papa. I think he is very proud to be, you know, the father right now of the NXT brand, and very proud of the work that they're putting in, as he should be. He should be proud of the work that he's doing. If not, then he's doing it wrong. I am not going to look at what he said here, though, and go after him too much or mock him or make fun of him and say, what's he been smoking? Is he back on the drugs? I'm not going to say that, because I get what he's saying. If you really look at what NXT is today and you look at the Attitude Era had all kinds of just shenanigans going on, right? It was car crash TV. There was always some weird shit going on and stuff that today would get them thrown off the air, right? There'd be just stuff going on those shows that you just could not do today. You just couldn't get away with the language and some of the stuff, the raunchy stuff with the women, and it just wouldn't fly. NXT today is basically a sanitized version of that in many ways. They are the definition of let's throw shit at the wall and see what sticks. And there's no gimmick or story that's too goofy or too silly for them to run with. And that's okay when you're the developmental brand, because your whole, you know, the whole point of it is to try new things and see what works and find out what doesn't. It's one of the things I appreciate about this Shawn Michaels version of NXT. You know, they have NXT Deadline, for example. I think December 9th, I think, is the date. That's going to be their next pay-per-view, their next PLE. It's their last one of the year. Well, it was a year ago on that show that they had the Iron Survivor match. And it turned out to be really good, and I expect them to bring the Iron Survivor matches back, you know, this year, because I don't see why they wouldn't. That was an example of them trying something new, and it worked. And so they're gonna go with it. They may try out another match concept or another idea that doesn't work, and it fails, and it falls flat on its face, and guess what? They'll learn from it, and they won't do it again. It's like one giant Petri dish. And they can try to create these things. Some will work out and some won't. So it borrows some of the aspects of the Attitude Era. The one glaring difference, though, to me is that, again, there's still this emphasis. It's not the black and gold. But even still, there is still this emphasis on the quality of the matches. And we saw it last night. You could look at Carmelo Hayes and Ilya Dragunov. It was a very physical match, but it was an excellent professional wrestling match. It was a war between two people. People are looking at it. They're going to grade it and judge it. Oh, the work rate was so great. That's not what the Attitude Era was. Nobody was talking about work rate or looking at these Attitude Era matches with these big names and thinking, oh, how was the work rate in that match? So in that's one big difference between, you know, even the NXT of today and the Attitude Era back then. But you have everybody on the show getting some sort of story. And that's something that Vince Russo always tried to do. Not always with the best success, but when he was writing for Vince and he was, you know, at the helm there during the Attitude Era, he was trying to give everybody a story. It didn't matter how big of a star they were or if you were the lowest guy on the totem pole there. Everyone had some sort of character. Everyone had some sort of story. That was one of the hallmarks of the Attitude Era. And that's one of the hallmarks of the way Shawn Michaels runs NXT. So he's not that off base. I know people are going to hear that and go, oh my God, what's wrong with Shawn Michaels? You know, again, give him a wellness check. But there are definite similarities between the way that he runs NXT and what he remembers from the Attitude Era. Trying new things, giving people stories, having these ridiculous skits and gimmicks. Some are going to work, some are not going to work. He's probably not wrong when he says that it's the closest thing you're going to get to an Attitude Era type of product. That doesn't mean he is saying that, hey, it's a modern-day Attitude Era, but there are characteristics that the two share. So if you really break down what he said, it's not all that ridiculous. All of my predictions ended up being bang on. I did miss some predictions for matches that weren't announced yet at the time, so they were incomplete. But I had Lynch, Dragunov, and Corbin all going over, and they did indeed go over. Although in the Corbin match, I thought it would be Von Wagner returning and costing Bron Breakker the match. It ended up being his manager. It was Mr. Stone, not Vaughn. Vaughn is still in the shop being repaired. Blair Davenport beat Kalani Jordan on the pre-show. Gigi Dolan attacked Davenport after the match. The two of them had a pull-apart brawl. Jordan is one of the women in this year's women's breakout tournament. Kicks off on NXT this Tuesday. She looked good in there for someone with her level of experience. You know, Davenport is much more polished than she is and well-traveled. But she needs more of an impactful finish, Davenport does. If she's going to use that Falcon Arrow, that did not look good. It did not have any real impact whatsoever. The intro video to No Mercy, once the main card kicked off, I loved it. They put the cold open up early on social media, so I commented on it the other day. But they did it in the form of the old N64 No Mercy video game. So the first shot you see is someone putting an old No Mercy cartridge into the gaming system. And then they just did a modern day takeoff with, you know, they had sprites, custom sprites for members of the WWE roster and the current NXT roster. Vic Joseph, even on commentary, he made reference to the old, you know, Dig Diggity Dog song from the video game. This was great. I love this intro. And a lot of people consider No Mercy to be one of, if not the greatest wrestling game of all time. I did play it. I didn't own an N64, but you know, I had friends who did, so I've played it. And you can play it. They have like modded versions of it online if you want to find an emulator. I'm sure people can play it, but this was a very, very cool intro to the show. Now, they open with Baron Corbin against Bron Breakker. Baron Corbin rode a motorcycle to the ring like he was The Undertaker in 2000. He said the entrance was actually inspired by Ghost Rider. Not to be confused with Ghost Rider, which I admit I used to watch on PBS when I was a kid. This was heel against heel, which can be a tough sell, but opening the show with it probably helped, because the crowd's always going to be up for the opening match. I thought it was decent. I will say Corbin's entrance and his new music, his new song is called Burn the Ships, really good. Really good stuff. I thought Von Wagner was going to return and cost Braun the match. It was Robert Stone. He dove off the top rope. Braun caught him, threw him out onto a pile of random bodies outside. But when he turned around, he walked right into an end of days and he got pinned. So it gives Corbin a win for whatever that's even worth at this point. And it doesn't hurt Braun because he took a distraction, and that's what it took to beat him. So it's not that big of a deal. And obviously, when Von Wagner does come back, that's the next feud. He moves on to feud with Von Wagner. Dirty Dom's reign as North American champion has come to an end. The title, I'm guessing, was going to probably go to Mustafa Ali on this show, but Ali got fired. And one man's misfortune is another man's opportunity. Trick Williams, he qualified on Tuesday for the right to challenge for the championship. And, you know, we hear a lot about Carmelo Hayes and Tiffany Stratton and the star potential they have on the main roster. I'm going to say right now, I actually think Trick Williams has more main roster star potential than Carmelo Hayes does. And I think he may end up being a bigger star on the main roster than Carmelo Hayes. And Hayes is a much better wrestler than Trick Williams is, you know, bell to bell. I mean, athletically, he's very gifted, the things he's able to do. But Williams has the size that they like. That's going to help him out a lot on the main roster. He looks great. He's charismatic. That entrance they gave him, it makes him look like a superstar. He's got the entire crowd when he comes out chanting, "Whoop that Trick." Dragon Lee was the guest referee for this. He got a lot of FaceTime this week, Dragon Lee did, on all four shows. Raw Monday night, NXT, SmackDown on Friday, and No Mercy last night. So he was the guest referee here for a match where Dominic Mysterio was considered the veteran. This was good. You know, you might hear some people overrating this. It was not great, but they got by with, you know, a lot of smoke and mirrors with all the ref bumps. Dragon Lee ate an accidental super kick. You would think that this guy got shot by a sniper rifle. He went down, he rolled out to the floor. I don't know what it is when these people put that stupid striped shirt on. It's like it zaps them of all their power. Because if Dragon Lee ate a super kick like that from Dom in their match they had on Monday, he would have kicked out at two. But here, he laid on the outside for like 5 minutes, selling it like he was dead. It was so goofy. And then after another ref bump later, Dominic grabbed the North American belt. He went to use it. Williams, though, hit a jumping knee strike that knocked the belt back into Dom's face. And Dragon Lee crawled back inside and counted the three. So they treated this like a big deal. The crowd loved the title change. Dominic becomes the first Judgment Day member to lose their title. That now creates yet another possible avenue for them to go down with Dragon Lee on the main roster. You know, if he's made an enemy out of the Judgment Day on Raw. And he's also got a match scheduled with Austin Theory for SmackDown this coming Friday. He's got his hands in a few different things, potentially, on the main roster. So things are looking up for Dragon Lee. Tony D'Angelo and Stax, they retain their NXT Tag Team titles in a four-way over the Creed Brothers, Los Lotharios, and the team of Lucian Price and Bronco Nima. That entrance for Price and Nima, where they ride the lowrider bicycles to the ring, like GTA style, that shit's gotta go. I'm sorry, they look absolutely ridiculous. That is going to be death on the main roster if they ever get called up, if they're doing that in their entrance. This was good. They did a spot where Tony D picked up both Garza and Carrillo very slowly. At the same time, he picked them up and then his leg gave out on him. And he immediately crumbled to the mat. He grabbed his knee in pain. It made me think of the Rick Boogs spot from WrestleMania last year when he tried to pick up both Usos on his shoulders and his knee buckled on him and he was out for a year. The medics came out, they helped him to the back. He did return later with a brace on his knee. If he was really hurt, they would not have let him back into the match with a knee injury like that. It played into the story of him making this heroic comeback, and in the end, he and Stax, they retained their titles. If he was really hurt, they would have called an audible anyway to put the belts probably back on the Creeds. Now, we got a vignette, and they aired a version of this on NXT on Tuesday. This was a slightly more expanded version of the same vignette, which showed somebody sitting down in a darkened room to watch TV. You see their hand, they have the remote control, they put the TV on, and the television showed brief clips of footage of the Cincinnati Bengals. It might have been training camp. I don't remember if it was training camp or an actual game, but it was old Cincinnati Bengals footage, and then they cut to a shot from an open of an old episode of WCW Saturday Night, and then they cut to various clips from modern-day WWE and NXT television. And very noticeably, they showed different shots of second-generation stars. So they focused specifically on Dominic Mysterio, Randy Orton was in there, Charlotte, the Usos, Solo Sikoa, Briggs and Jensen from NXT, Bron Breakker, Von Wagner, who of course his father was one of the Beverly Brothers. So that was a nice touch that I picked up on in watching this. And then at the very end, when he turns the TV off, whoever this person is, you look in the reflection of the television screen and you can clearly see that it's Brian Pillman Jr. So this is their way of introducing Brian Pillman Jr., who signed not too long ago with WWE. They are introducing him to NXT television. Question is he going to keep his name? If they're already making references to his father's past and him being a second-generation star, then it would make sense for him to keep his name. But, you know, Bron Breakker didn't keep his. So it's not a guarantee he's going to be Brian Pillman Jr., but he really should be Brian Pillman Jr. And this is the place for him to be. I mean, look, in AEW, he was there for a while. He did the tag team thing with Griff Garrison. There was one point where he actually worked with MJF on television, and he did this impassioned promo on him, and it looked like maybe they were going to give him a push. But he probably wasn't ready for that push. He wasn't great in AEW. There was something there. There was something to build on. But he wasn't great. I mean, let's just be honest. He needs a lot of seasoning. He needs a lot of work. NXT is the right place for him to be. He doesn't have the chops that his old man did on promos, but maybe they can pull something out of him down there. So it's the right place for him to be. And we'll see how many weeks of vignettes we get before we actually see him. Because he hasn't been signed for very long. I mean, he reported to the Performance Center. I don't even know if has it been a month? Maybe it's been 4 to 6 weeks. It hasn't been that long. In the back, Trick Williams shows up in a locker room where Carmelo Hayes is getting ready for his big championship match. And he celebrates with Hayes. Carmelo was so focused and in the zone, he looked surprised. He didn't even realize that Trick had won the championship. So I wonder if that's something that may come up in an eventual promo. But once he realized that Trick went out there and did the deal, he got very happy and they embraced and they took a moment to enjoy being at the top of the mountain together, right? Hayes, the NXT champion, Trick, the North American champion. Unfortunately for them, it would be very short-lived, is what I'm trying to say. I don't know what I'm saying. It's a very short-lived celebration here with these two as champions. Noam Dar, he retained his Heritage Cup over Butch. It was a good match. I didn't love it. I'm just not that into the whole rounds format that they use for this. But this is another example of what I talked about before when I mentioned Shawn Michaels and them trying different things. This is a holdover idea that they use in NXT UK, and he decided to bring it over to the main brand. So I have no issue with them, you know, having something like that and trying something different. It's just I'm not a real fan of it. I'm not that into it. And this here had tons of interference. It was a very lame finish to an otherwise good match. Gallus came out. Joe Coffey knocked Butch out. That allowed Noam Dar to get the pin, and he keeps the cup. Then it was time for the NXT Championship, which did not go on last. It was Carmelo Hayes defending against Ilya Dragunov, a rematch from their battle at Great American Bash, which was excellent. Their first match was great. This one was even better. Dragunov hit a superplex, Hayes hit a codebreaker, Dragunov came right back with his H-bomb forearm for a near fall. Dragunov hit another H-bomb, this time it was from the middle rope, and again, Carmelo Hayes kicked out. So they fought on the apron, Hayes hit a cutter off the apron to the floor, Hayes came off the top, but Dragunov nailed him out of midair with a clothesline, and at that point, Dragunov went to the top, he hit a super H-bomb, and he got the three count to win the NXT Championship clean in the middle of the ring. And Dragunov helped Hayes to his feet. The two of them embraced. There was no attack. There was no, you know, sour sport where he wouldn't shake the man's hand. They shook hands, and Dragunov celebrated very intensely. Everything Ilya Dragunov does is intense. I could picture him waking up in the morning out of bed and just screaming and flailing his arms around. Everything this fucking guy does is intense. From start to finish, from morning to night. A 5-star effort from from two five-star performers and a match of the year contender, one of two, on this show. And what I love most about these Ilya Dragunov matches, it's the intensity that he brings. He brings the best out of everyone that he is in the ring with, which is why I think it was a wise choice to put the title on him. Carmelo Hayes had a good run, but it's time for the story with him and Trick to progress and move to that next chapter. And we got a glimpse of what that is at the end of the show. So I'm skipping ahead here, but they showed Hayes at the very end of the show coming to the back. We see Trick Williams is there. He's got his North American title over his shoulder, a title that Carmelo Hayes used to have. And Hayes apologizes to him for not being able, you know, for both of them to leave as champions that night. Trick tells him, look, you fought like a champ. You got nothing to apologize for. You could see Carmelo Hayes. He started staring briefly, but he was staring at the North American title and he was patting the title. When they went in for the hug, he was patting the title. There's a story brewing there between those two. And it's not going to end well for their friendship. I don't see the two of them being called up to the main roster together. So they're going to do the split before Hayes eventually moves up to Raw or SmackDown. But this was it was subtle, but not so subtle thing that they did at the end of the show. And then it was Becky Lynch against Tiffany Stratton. They headlined the show in an Extreme Rules match for the NXT Women's Championship. And both women took a beating here. I'm going to talk about Becky's injury in a little bit, but a few minutes into the match, Tiffany Stratton was already bleeding hard way from the head. Lynch pulled out a black bag at one point, and you know, you would think there were thumbtacks inside. Nope, no thumbtacks. But it had Barbie doll parts. Body parts to various Barbie dolls, since Tiffany Stratton is like a real-life Barbie doll, you see. So Becky slammed Tiffany onto the doll parts for two. That just sounds so wrong. Onto the doll parts for two. Stratton left the ring, so Becky started throwing various doll arms and legs at her. And Stratton would swat them away with a trash can lid. That was like her shield. Becky placed Tiffany into a trash can and draped her over the middle rope and then hit her diving leg drop. Tiffany fought back. She piled up a dozen chairs. And Becky ended up slamming her onto them. Becky in here ended up bruising her elbow up pretty badly. And she suplexed Tiffany into the barricade outside on the floor. And then she went under the ring and she grabbed a table to the delight of everyone in the audience. Tiffany, though, hit her with a kendo stick. She set that table up outside. But then she lost track of where Becky was. She's like, where is she? She's searching for her. She pulls up the ring skirt, and the spot was Becky was going to blast her in the face with a fire extinguisher. She was going to hose her down. There was a delay of about 2 seconds, though, so Tiffany just sort of stared at her and waited, and then she got sprayed with the extinguisher. And Becky then pulled out Barbie. Not the doll. Mick Foley's old Barbie. A baseball bat, wrapped in barbed wire like she was Negan from The Walking Dead. And so she nails Tiffany once with the plastic bat, but missed her on the second swing. And the bat went flying in the general direction of the announcers. Booker T was backing away like his life was in danger. He didn't sign up for a plastic barbed wire bat, you know, being ricocheted into his face. So Tiffany then drove Becky through the barricade by the timekeeper's area with a running handspring elbow. That looked good. Becky recovered, put Tiffany on the announce table. Tiffany escaped the manhandle slam attempt. She knocked Becky backwards, and Becky landed very neatly in one of those cushy announce chairs. So she's sitting in the chair. Tiffany then came off the announce desk with a cannonball, knocked the chair over with Becky in it. Stratton put Becky on the table outside the ring that she had set up earlier on, and she went up to the top rope, and she hit a giant swanton bomb off the top rope onto the table, which did not break. It bent, but it did not break. This woman is fearless. That came across very evident watching this match. She is not afraid to take risks, and she makes them look great. Stratton put Lynch in the ring, hit another senton bomb for a near fall. Becky rolled to ringside. Tiffany missed a prettiest moonsault ever to the floor, and Becky hit her with a manhandle slam. Back in the ring, Tiffany blocked a disarm her attempt with a roll-up. And Tiffany hit Becky with a rolling senton onto the pile of chairs in the ring. She went up, hit the prettiest moonsault ever. Unfortunately for her, she missed and landed on the chairs instead. Immediately got back up to her feet and got caught with a manhandle slam onto the pile of chairs, and Becky pinned her to retain the championship. My only critique of Stratton during this match, and it's a minor one because the effort from both these women was tremendous and the work was good, and Tiffany really impressed here. But she was a little too quick to get up after some big spots. It's possible they were being rushed for time, but she would take a big move. Like even that last moonsault that she missed. Hits this big moonsault off the top rope and lands on top of chairs and immediately gets right back up to her feet because the spot was, we're going to go into the manhandle slam. So she just got right back up. But there were a few times that that happened here during the match. And it's just like you just move on to the next spot, right? Like they had to get their shit in and it just left no time for them to really sell some of the damage. But that would be my only critique here. This was excellent. You know, it's not going to win match of the year. I do think it belongs on the list of contenders. There's just been so many great matches this year. This is not going to win. But that is two match of the year contenders for Becky Lynch this year, including her cage match at Payback with Trish Stratus. Tiffany loses again. I think, though, that she gained a lot from her showing here. It's the second time that Tiffany Stratton has really shined in one of these hardcore-type matches. Her lights-out match with Wendy Chu last summer was really good. That was the one with the Legos in the ring. I remember thinking that was a very good match. I think she got hurt in that match, which is why Tiffany disappeared for a few months. I tell you what, Legos hurt a lot more than Barbie doll parts do. Becky needed 11 stitches to close a sick gash on her arm. She posted a photo on her Instagram. That orange shit that you see spilling out of her arm, that's fatty tissue. It reminds me of the gash I got on my leg 5 years ago. It's disgusting. After the match, she acknowledged Tegan Nox in the crowd, and she is going to be defending her NXT championship against Tegan on Raw tomorrow night, assuming she gets medically cleared. But she didn't break anything. She should be okay otherwise, so I don't see any reason why the match wouldn't happen. But this was, again, a 1-2 punch here to close out this show. The rest of the card had some good stuff, but it really, those two main events is really where this show got raised. I would say it raised the show from what I would have said was a 6 or a 7 to an 8. Two excellent main events that you should go out of your way to watch. Now, Becky Lynch made headlines this week also in an interview that she gave to the New York Post, and she commented on the state of the WWE women's division, specifically the Raw women's division. She said, currently we're a little light on women with credibility on Raw. So any way I can give these women who are great credibility, give them a match, give them an outing and a showcase in a championship match, I think that only benefits everybody. It benefits the audience because we have more women that we care about and more women that I can beat. I need people on this level, but if nobody's getting any TV time, if nobody's getting any story time, then they can't rise up because nobody knows who the hell they are. And when asked which women she thought she had the potential to help elevate, she pointed to people like Zoe Stark, Indy Hartwell, Xia Li, and Candice LeRae. And she also mentioned Tegan Nox. She wants to wrestle Tegan Nox, which she will be doing on Raw tomorrow night. She says, I think Xia Li has such a cool character and we haven't seen any of these things from her. She had a little momentum and then it all stopped. It's hard to gain momentum if you don't get no TV time. And it's hard to get TV time if there is nothing to fight for. So Becky Lynch is in that position where she's not really worried about her job. So she can go out there and she can say these things that you know other women on the roster are thinking. These are the same things that I've been talking about on this show when it comes to the women's division in WWE. It's sort of the self-fulfilling prophecy where why can't some of these women get over? Look, some of these women will never get over at a high level. You call up prospects, you don't expect every prospect to pan out. But there's no reason that some of these women that she mentioned that are just bench warmers, that are sitting in the back with nothing to do, There's no reason to think that some of them can't get over. I've mentioned the cool vignettes they started airing for Xia Li when she first got called up to the main roster on SmackDown, right? The Protector. And they were actually very well done. 2 weeks later, she cut a promo in the back, a 20-second promo. Basically, she didn't want to protect people anymore. So that was the end of that. And now they just use her on main event. Once you're slotted in that position, it's very hard to recover from that. She's lucky she didn't end up on the cutting block last week like so many other people. But Becky is absolutely right. It's the same thing that I have been talking about. It's hard to get over. It's hard to get momentum when you don't even get television time. And it's not enough to just get TV time. You can throw anybody on TV. What do you do with them once they're on TV? Is it one and done? Do you give them a story? Do you give them a character? Do you give them consistency where they can appear on television the next week and the week after that and the week after that? I've criticized Tony Khan and AEW for the same thing, just in general, not even just with the women. It's one thing to put somebody on TV, but if they vanish for 6 weeks, then what the hell is the point? You're just wasting television time. You may as well invest that in somebody else that you know you're going to use. So Becky is just speaking the hard truth here. She's not wrong when she mentions these people and the problems the WWE has with their women's division. And it's not just a Raw problem. It's a Raw and SmackDown problem. And all these people that she could potentially work with and help elevate, throw Jade Cargill on that list, right? To circle back to my idea. Jade is another one who would benefit from working with someone at the level that Becky is in that company. And clearly they have big plans for her. Right? I'm sure Xia Li and Mi Chin and Tegan Nox and all these people are looking at Jade and going, okay, well, she's going to leapfrog all of us because the woman looks like a star and she's being treated like a star. But it would be nice if they tried to give a little momentum to some of these other people as well. One last NXT thing. They did make the announcement last night. Halloween Havoc is back again this year. They've been doing the Halloween Havoc thing for a few years now. And they're spreading it out over the course of 2 weeks. So part one of Halloween Havoc is the Tuesday, October 24th episode of NXT, and part two will be on Halloween night, which happens to fall on a Tuesday this year. So October 31st will be the closing night of Halloween Havoc on USA. Let's get to some of your mailbag questions. We got some good stuff here. And if you have questions, you can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I had a few people email me about Ric Flair on the Kill Tony podcast, walking off stage in the middle of the show. They wanted to know my thoughts on the whole thing. And I got to be honest, I never even heard of Kill Tony before. So this was my first time watching it. I got an education here. This is my first time watching it. I have a friend that knows about it, so he kind of clued me in as to what it is. And then I watched it. For those who don't know, Kill Tony is a stage show. It's hosted by Tony Hinchcliffe. He's a comedian. You might know him from the Joe Rogan show. He's the one who's always feeding Joe wrestling trivia whenever he has a wrestler on the show because he's a fan. And I guess Ric Flair is one of his heroes. Ric Flair is one of his idols. So he got Rick to agree to come on the show. The video of this is on YouTube, by the way. If you just type in Kill Tony, they have a whole channel devoted to the show. And all the shows are up there in video form. It's like it's like a giant roast where they invite amateur comedians to come up and they have, I think, 60 seconds to do a set. And the ones I saw were generally fucking terrible. That's why they're amateur comedians. But it gets them exposure, but then they just get absolutely roasted. So you would think that since he agreed to come on the show, Ric Flair would know what the format of the show actually was. Evidently, that was not the case. I watched it. First of all, I'm sure Flair was at least 10 beers in before he even walked out on stage. Now, Flair always sounds punch drunk, but I guarantee you he was drinking heavily before he even walked out there. He sounded sloshed the entire time. He sat down with Tony at the table at the dais that they had there. And they had some other people out there, before they started bringing out the amateurs. And Flair was having fun. He had a big smile on his face. He was telling stories that didn't really fit. This was not really a wrestling audience, but he was enjoying himself. And then he turned into Debbie Downer and he started talking about all the wrestlers that have died this year. Terry Funk, Iron Sheik, Superstar Billy Graham, Bray Wyatt. I mean, this really wasn't the type of environment to bring that up, so that brought the mood down for a bit. And then things got a little bit lighter after that, and Flair's just yapping on, and Tony just talks over him at one point to introduce another comedian to sit with them at the table, this guy Ari, who comes out of the crowd. I thought it was Necro Butcher. I thought Necro Butcher is back. I swear to God, he looked just like him. And everyone's going nuts for this guy. He takes his shirt off, and it's like Flair's entire demeanor changes when he realizes he's not the center of attention anymore. And it's not just about him. After that, they're trotting comedians out on stage and roasting them, and Flair is literally looking down at his phone. He's not even paying attention. He could not look any less interested in what was going on if he tried. I thought maybe he fell asleep. Then, almost an hour in, so he stuck it out. I mean, he was there for almost an hour. They bring this guy out. They're riding him pretty hard. And they ask the comedians questions about themselves after they do their 60 seconds. And this guy mentions that he's a high school wrestling coach. And someone says, man, this is fucking boring. Hey, Ric Flair, tell us another story. And everyone starts laughing. At which point, Ric Flair, all self-righteous, says, I'm going to say this and then I'm going to leave. And everyone's like, oh, no, no, no. And Tony tries to talk him into staying. Flair's mumbling away. And he says he won't ever make fun of someone who donates their time to support youth athletics. And then he mentions that his son was a great amateur wrestler and he died of a heroin overdose. So he's not going to make fun of anybody who donates their time. And whoever was there from the band on stage, They start playing sad piano music in the background, and everyone just starts laughing. Now, mind you, Flair had already said he was leaving even before they did that, so it's not like that's what caused him to leave. But he said he's not going to make fun of people who donate their time to children. He's not going to make fun of people. First of all, it's a fucking roast. That's what they do. If no one clued him in about that aspect of the show, then that's on them. But the minute he walked out on that stage, he should have known what he was in for, and he should have left right then and there if that's how he honestly felt. It's a fucking roast. And you're going to leave because they're making fun of people. So that's ridiculous enough. But for Ric Flair, of all people, to get on his high horse and say he's not going to tolerate insulting other people, Or that he won't say negative things about people. How many times has this guy said negative things about other people on his own podcast? Let alone in shoot interviews. Never has any issue doing that. Now he's all high and mighty, and he has a problem with it. Apparently that isn't even the uncut episode. It was edited. The people who were there live said Flair was talking about how much he loved Asian pussy while staring right at an Asian woman in the front row. He told a story about washing a buffalo. I have no idea. Don't even ask. Maybe that's a euphemism for something. I don't know. All I know is everything seemed fine until the focus wasn't on him, and he started taking some of the incoming fire. Right? They made jokes about him being old. Suddenly, he wasn't down to make fun of other people, and then he left. And we know Ric Flair is a very transactional person. If somebody says something positive and something wonderful about Ric Flair, like I remember there were moments on his podcast, they would put clips up and it's like, oh, did you hear what this guy said about me? Like he'd ask Conrad, did you hear what so-and-so said about me this week, right? What a wonderful thing. And then he would put that person over. But, you know, if somebody says something negative, forget about it. You'll get a whole fucking Flair rant on his show. It's just how he has always been. And so I'm sure that played a little bit of a role as well in why he didn't want to be there anymore. I don't think he was expecting to be the one on the butt end of some of those shots. And that's what did it. Now remember, this is not a wrestling audience here. There may have been some wrestling fans in the audience. But in this environment here, he's not in a wrestling audience. He comes out there and yes, some people are going to, you know, bow down to him and all that shit because they know who Ric Flair is. And Flair, in a lot of ways, has transcended pro wrestling. You see him in rap videos and at award shows, so a lot of people know who Ric Flair is. but not everybody. So not everybody is going to kiss the ring and kiss his ass and treat him with all this reverence, especially in this environment where everybody is shitting on each other. That's just what they do. And I don't think he was ready for that. He wasn't expecting that. But that's the format. If he can't handle it, he shouldn't have been there in the first place. So those are my thoughts on the Kill Tony stuff. I mean, it was comical watching Flair get up on his high horse and say, oh, I'm going to make fun of people. I don't want to have anything to do with that. I'm going to leave. Does Flair even do his podcast anymore? I feel like it's been months since I've heard anything about it. Did he flake out on this one like he did all the other ones? He's had like four of them at this point. He did one years ago for MLW Radio. I think that was the first one. Then there was one with Conrad that he just quit because he got bored. Then he tried one with Mark Madden, which was a disaster. And the two of them had like a 30 or 40 year friendship that apparently got blown up. They had a huge falling out. So he went back to Conrad. And now it looks like he's quit again. James from Staten Island. I don't watch WWE as much as I used to because it's just hard for me to get invested when I know they don't care. But the few clips I see online, they are constantly pushing the narrative that John Cena is the greatest of all time. And to me, it is just nauseating. First off, what did he do that had bigger impact than guys like Hogan, Austin, Rock, Andre, Undertaker, Bret, Shawn, Flair, and Dusty? Secondly, WWE used to have a lot more people watching their show, and anyone that checks the ratings during the Cena run can see that there was a sizable portion of the audience that quit watching. At my last point, he was a babyface character that was getting booed out of the building relentlessly for over a decade. In other words, he could not do his job right, which was to get people behind him. I've never understood how anyone can say John Cena is the greatest ever simply because he had no scandals and he did a lot of charity work. Just because someone is a better person doesn't mean that they were better at their job. Am I crazy or do I have a point? So, when it comes to this greatest of all time stuff, and they have been calling John Cena the greatest of all time now for a few years. So I think even back a couple of years ago when he came back to wrestle Roman Reigns, they were calling him the greatest of all time. That is a Vince McMahon thing. That started under Vince when, before all the scandals and everything, and, you know, everything kind of changed there for 6 months. That's a Vince McMahon call. It's their branding. They want John Cena referred to as the greatest of all time. And the greatest of all time stuff is all subjective. There is no one singular greatest of all time. There's just too many variables involved, including the era that they worked. Times change. Metrics change. Television and ratings change, etc., etc. WWE calling John Cena the greatest of all time, you know, in the eyes of Vince McMahon, you got to think about it in terms of his 78-year-old eyeballs. Okay? In the eyes of Vince McMahon, I think that he truly believes that John Cena is the greatest superstar of all time. And it's not hard to see why. John Cena was the consummate pro. John Cena was the ultimate WWE superstar. He is everything that Vince McMahon could possibly want out of his top guy. He always looked great. He appealed to the kids. He sold tons of merch. He was the perfect ambassador for the company, right? More make-a-wishes granted than anybody else in history, which is a great thing. Never got into any trouble outside the ring. Vince McMahon did not have to worry about a scandal or a drug test failure or an airport outburst or a social media meltdown or a barroom brawl or anything like that. There were never two more loyal top guys for Vince than The Undertaker and John Cena. And the only reason they don't call The Undertaker the greatest of all time is because he wasn't as, you know, mainstream marketable for them as John Cena was. Undertaker was never the face of the company the way that John Cena was. So Cena made them more money. But he also never questioned his boss on anything, it seems. And that was also one of his faults. Loyal to a fault. There were times where I wish he would have pushed back on decisions that Vince McMahon made. And he didn't. And that was sometimes to the detriment of the company as far as the people that he was working with. It was to the detriment of his opponents. So I'm not surprised they branded Cena as the greatest of all time. He was deeply unpopular with a lot of fans for a good portion of his run. And Vince was so afraid not only of turning him heel, but he was so afraid to get anybody else over at his level that there were a lot of people who probably could have gotten over at a top level who never did because they were fed to John Cena instead, or because Cena just had to go over on them. That's more on the booking than anything else. John Cena does not bear all of the responsibility for that. Now, do I think that John Cena is the greatest of all time? No, I don't. Does he belong in the conversation? Sure. He's worthy of being in the conversation because even though he had the machine behind him, and look, to a large extent, all these people have the machine behind them. You don't think Hogan didn't have the machine behind him? Like Roman Reigns right now has the machine behind him? Yeah, I mean, there are people like a Daniel Bryan who did not have the machine behind them, right, until they just sort of had to be dragged kicking and screaming. But to some extent, a lot of these top guys have had the machine put behind them. So yes, Cena had that. He was still a needle mover for the company at a time when they didn't have many other people moving the needle. And he had more longevity on top than all but a very select few in the history of that company. Steve Austin, let's use Stone Cold as an example. Steve Austin was way hotter as a star than John Cena was, but for a much shorter period of time. Austin's run at the top, you know, that got derailed by injuries. But at his peak, no one was hotter than Stone Cold Steve Austin. The only one you could make an argument for would be Hulk Hogan. I'm talking like peak Hulkamania in the mid to late 80s. They built everything around that man. Vince McMahon went national on the back of Hulk Hogan. Rock and wrestling. They gave the man his own cartoon. Hulk Hogan was a household name, even with people who didn't watch wrestling. They knew who Hulk Hogan was, and probably do today. Although for some very different reasons in many cases, some not so great reasons. But this level of star power I'm talking about with Hogan and Austin, John Cena does not even come close. I'm talking in a wrestling sense now. Forget the movies and all the outside stuff. Like, he doesn't come close. Cena deserves to be in the conversation. And I also think he still doesn't get enough credit for his matches. He had some excellent matches, you know, during his career with Edge and CM Punk and AJ Styles, Brock Lesnar, Seth Rollins, Daniel Bryan, Shawn Michaels. Even when he got demoted down the card a little bit, that U.S. title open challenge in 2015 was one of the more fun things on WWE television. And he had some great matches with that too. I remember one that he had with Cesaro. He gets a lot of crap for his in-ring work, but his resume of top matches is outstanding. So if you want to look at John Cena as someone who, you know, as far as his in-ring portfolio is concerned, there are some people who still don't give, you know, the guy his due, and I think it's bullshit, because if you really just stop and think about the matches he had, of course, as I say that, people will be like, oh yeah, well that was all because of the person he was in the ring with. Yes, as if these people were wrestling a fucking broom. It doesn't matter. Yes, he was in there with AJ Styles and Shawn Michaels, and some of these guys are the greats, right, of all time in the ring. But he still went out there and he had great matches with all of them. You can't just ignore that. You can't just give credit to one person because you don't like the other. It's bullshit. It's always been a bullshit argument. And that's to say nothing of the matches with The Rock. I didn't care for the second one, but the first one, yeah, it was okay. But they did huge business for them, especially that first match. And Rock coming back and wrestling a singles match for the first time in 8 years, that had a lot to do with that. But Cena was still part of that. So, you know, is he the GOAT? Not to James, he's not. And he's not mine. But it's not as ludicrous as you make it out to be, because when you think about it, he's everything that Vince McMahon could ever ask for at a top star. If he could clone John Cena and have an army of them, he would do it in a heartbeat. If he can manufacture them on a product line and just churn them out one by one, he would do it. So it's no surprise that Vince McMahon thinks of John Cena as the greatest of all time. Chen from Merced, California. I was watching your SmackDown review stream, and when you mentioned Tupac and California Love, it hit me that LA Knight's theme song sounds an awful lot like California Love, from the robotic background noise and vocals to some aspects of the instrumental as well. What do you think? Also, what is the background behind the name LA Knight? From his wiki, it seems he's not from California, so how did they come up with that name for him? He's not. He's from Maryland. The LA stands for Los Angeles. Los Angeles is where he moved to. And since he came from a small town, his friends teased him about it. So that's where it comes from. It's a nickname that his friends gave to him. As far as his music, you're not the first person I've heard mention that connection to California love. I hear it too. It's absolutely inspired by Tupac. There's no way that was an accident. But it's like the story that DDP tells about his music in WCW. Jimmy Hart was doing the music for them at the time, and he went to Dallas and said, "What kind of music do you like?" And Dallas at the time really was into Nirvana. And he said Smells Like Teen Spirit was his favorite song of theirs, and you know, Nirvana's going to be the band of the 90s and all that. All Jimmy Hart did was reverse the chords in the song. But it's unmistakable when you listen to it that it's a ripoff, it sounds like a ripoff of Smells Like Teen Spirit. You know, same thing with Chris Jericho's WCW theme, I think his second one. It was modeled after Pearl Jam, Evenflow. Very clear if you listen to the song. And they're both dubbed over on all the WCW stuff on Peacock. But that was more blatant than the LA Knights song. There's a difference between inspired by and basically copied from. Matey from New York, what are the five best matches of Dolph Ziggler's career? So I did think about this in no particular order. These are the ones I just scratched down here. Dolph and Miz, No Mercy 2016. The Royal Rumble match that he had with Edge in 2011. The Bragging Rights match that he had with Daniel Bryan in 2010. The Team Cena against the Authority Survivor Series match in 2014, where he was the sole survivor. And the Money in the Bank cash-in on Alberto Del Rio, just because it was his greatest moment. So those would be my five. And Steve from Virginia. Can you explain the Nasty Boys and Ken Shamrock hotel incident, please? Okay, so this is a famous story, and there's different versions of how it all went down. Everybody involved has at least a slightly different version of how it happened. But one thing everybody agrees on is that Robert Fuller, so you may know him better as Colonel Robert Parker from WCW, or Tennessee Lee from the WWF when he managed Jeff Jarrett, he saved Ken Shamrock's life. That's the one kind of indisputable fact about the whole thing, is that he saved Shamrock's life. Shamrock would not be here today were it not for the intervention of Robert Fuller. So this took place in 1990. It was right before the Nasty Boys jumped over to the WWF. They were working for a promotion in the Carolinas. I don't remember the name of it. It doesn't matter. Shamrock was working for the same promotion. And he was early into his wrestling career. This was years before UFC even existed. So some people may not realize that Ken Shamrock was a wrestler before he was, you know, a fighter and then came back and joined WWF. He had done wrestling early in his career. As Shamrock tells the story, and there's been countless shoot interviews, and you can find all the clips on YouTube. I've seen them all over the years. As Shamrock tells the story, he was at a bar with a friend of his who worked on the ring crew. And the guy had either his girlfriend or his fiance with him, I don't remember which. In the version that Fuller tells, it was Shamrock's girl. And he implied that, you know, all the wrestlers knew her. So she was a rat, is what he's basically saying. Either way, Brian Knobbs was drunk, right? What a shock. And he admits it too. He goes, he was fucking shit-faced. He has barely any recollection of the things that happened that night. But he was drunk, and he got the whole thing started. He got the ball rolling down the hill. He was being a drunken dick. The Nasty Boys don't exactly have sterling reputations, so this is not a stretch. Shamrock said that Knobbs started grabbing one of the girl's breasts, like they belonged to him or something. Maybe he was jealous that hers were only slightly bigger than his. I don't know. But Shamrock took exception to this, and he asked him to stop. That only wound Knobbs up even more, and he kept touching her. Then he pie-faces Shamrock, and Ken had to be restrained by one of the bouncers. So the Nasty Boys get kicked out. Shamrock, though, is fuming. Okay, he is fuming, and he cannot let this go. And he knew that they were staying at the same hotel. Because all the wrestlers, all the boys were put up at the same hotel. So later on, when he gets to the hotel, he is completely enraged. And probably has some alcohol in him too, which doesn't help. And honestly, he should have just left it alone at that point. He bears some of the responsibility here in what happened. He went banging on every door looking to find which room the Nasty Boys were in. When he came to Robert Fuller's door, Fuller was booking for the promotion at the time. He answers the door. Shamrock is screaming, "Where are they? Where are Knobs and Sags? Where are they?" And all Fuller could do is just point him in the general direction of their room. I think he maybe told him which floor that he thought they were on. The version that Fuller tells differs in this way. He claims it was 3 a.m. He was woken up by a knock at the door. When he answered, buck-ass naked, it was the woman. And she was crying, "Oh, Ken's going to kill Knobs. Ken's going to kill Knobs." And then he sees Shamrock coming down the stairs. And Shamrock asks him, you know, "Where are they?" And he tells them, you know, they're up on the second or third floor. In Shamrock's version, when he found their room, he knocked the door down. And he found Knobs passed out face down in bed. And that's the last thing that he remembers. Because from what he was told, Sags was hiding and he smashed him in the back of the head with a steel telephone. That's such a wrestling way of describing it, by the way. Like a steel chair, the steel ring post, the steel steps. Now we have a steel telephone. But he said the base of the phone was made of steel. And from what he was told and what the police report said, he got smashed in the head with it, knocked out cold. At which point, both Nasty Boys start putting the boots to him. I guess he thinks that Knobs was only pretending to be sleeping in bed. I absolutely believe that Knobs was passed out for real. He even admits he was completely fucked up that night. In the Jerry Sags version of the story, Shamrock got to their room. Immediately he jumped on top of Knobs, who was passed out in bed. He starts pounding away on Knobs, because Knobs did have a black eye out of all this. And that's when Sags decided to intervene to defend his partner. Whether it was Sags alone or Sags and Knobs together, it was probably just Sags, and Knobs slept through the entire thing. Even Shamrock can't be sure it was both of them because he doesn't remember anything after seeing Knobs face down in the bed, so how would he know? Sags claims he never hit him with a phone. He just used his hands and feet. Shamrock, though, he got fucked up badly to the point where Fuller, when he finally got to the room because he could hear the commotion, he said, "Oh boy," right? He goes to the room to see what's going on. When he gets there, he said that Shamrock was nearly unrecognizable. His head had swollen so much it looked like a basketball. The other thing that Fuller saw when he got to the room, first thing he saw, was Sags had Shamrock about waist high. He was holding him. He had dragged him out to the balcony. And he had him about waist high. He was about, like, dead weight. He's about to throw him over the railing onto the pavement 3 floors down. He was going to throw Ken Shamrock off the balcony to his death. So when Fuller got there, he and Sags, they locked eyes, and Sags immediately drops Shamrock on the floor, and he realizes, oh shit, like, he's in some real trouble here. And Fuller looks at Shamrock, and he goes, "He's not going to make it. You got to call 911. Because, again, if you don't, this guy's going to die." That's how badly injured he was. And according to Shamrock, they almost lost him on the way to the hospital. They had to resuscitate him. He claims he was laid up for months after that. In the Observer at the time, Meltzer said he was beaten half to death and he had his jaw wired shut. But they brought him out at the next set of TV tapings and they ran an angle claiming that Fuller had something to do with what happened to him. So, maybe he was laid up for months, but he was apparently good enough to show up at the next set of tapings. A couple months later, the Nasty Boys were working for Vince. Shamrock, he eventually went on to work in Japan, so their paths did not cross again until many years later. There was a very chance encounter at an airport when Shamrock was working for the WWF. He was with Billy Gunn, and he noticed, I guess off in the distance, he sees Brian Knobs. And you remember how Shamrock used to snap on television, like he would get in the zone? Well, he got in the zone for real. He saw red. And it didn't help that a lot of the WWF crew, they had ribbed him previously and kind of egged him on and gotten on his case about the story. It was a very famous story. I think Steve Austin, I'd love for someone to ask Austin this one day. I think Austin got up in front of everybody on the plane once and said something like, "World's most dangerous man, Jerry Sags." And like Shamrock would just like sit there with his head in his hands. just like stuff like that. Owen Hart was another one who I think ribbed him about it. I mean, look, you poke a bear enough times, eventually he's going to bite back. Well, now here was his chance for revenge. And Billy Gunn took one look at Shamrock's face and he knew that this was going to get real ugly. And he tells him, dude, it's not worth it. Don't do it. But he went up to Knobs. He told him he was going to kill him. And Billy tried to get between them. Knobs ran away. He found Sags. When Shamrock saw Sags, he jumped over a bunch of seats to get to him. He was ready to kill this motherfucker. This man was ready to not only end his own career, but spend the rest of his life on death row, just to get these guys back for what they did to him. And as Shamrock tells it, Sags pussed out in front of all the boys. He said, oh, if you hit me, it's a federal offense. And he says, at that point, all the rage and the anger that he was just overcome with just washed away. Because he realized what a pathetic, sad sack this guy is. But he said it was very satisfying. And that was the end of it, according to him. Knobs and Sags, they have said that they regretted the whole thing. And that it happened because of a no-good rat. And a rat should never come between the boys. So it was the woman's fault. I guess it was her fault that they nearly threw an unconscious man off a balcony to his death. Damn rats. Amazing. Only in pro wrestling. But that is one of the more famous stories, and probably one of the worst ones that I've ever heard, as far as the damage they did to Shamrock. Because he came awfully close to going off that balcony and, you know, three floors up, even two floors up. If that happened, that would have been the end of Ken Shamrock. And that concludes story time with Solomonster for this week. If you enjoyed the show, drop a tweet. I sure appreciate that. Always spreading the word on social media helps the show out a lot. So go ahead and do that. You could email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I'm going to be live on YouTube very late tonight whenever Wrestle Dream is over. If I'm not in a dream myself, I will be live on YouTube to recap the entire show. And the audio should be up by midday at the latest tomorrow, as it usually is. I'll be back next Sunday with you for episode 829 of the Solomonster Sounds Off. And of course, on YouTube this week on Monday and Wednesday. I will also be on YouTube Friday night. Friday is my birthday, but I will be streaming. We'll be hanging out. We'll have a little birthday party for SmackDown on Friday night. So you can find me on the channel throughout the week. And again, I will see you back here for 829. Next Sunday, 1 year older, next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Rey Fénix won the international title from Jon Moxley. Moxley got hurt, and he called an audible during the match to put Fénix over. Rey Fénix drops him with a Fénix driver. Rick Knox counts one, he counts two, and he holds up the count before three, even though Moxley did not kick out, Moxley did not get a shoulder up, and he holds up the count instead of counting the three, and it ruined the finish because there was no reason for him to hold up the count. It looked stupid. You could even see Moxley looking up, mouthing the words, fuck you. Rick Knox is the worst referee that I have ever seen. It's almost impossible to conceive of just how bad of a referee he is. He is the Angel Hernandez of pro wrestling. Thank God he didn't become a lifeguard, because you would have bodies washing up on shore every day.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, each week bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster Sounds Off.